Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Hey, this is Toni Morris with you again at the Babja Lounge in sunny San Francisco. We are here today, 2010 San Francisco Black Film Festival. And I have with me all the way from Chicago, by way of Chicago and L.A., Miss Christine Ackham and Cliff Ward. So tell me, why you guys come out today?
Oh, we just heard about the San Francisco Black Film Festival. We're excited to participate. You know, got the emails and, you know, couldn't wait to get out here and show our work.
Okay. So tell me, what is your film about?
Our film is about the 1970s film called The Spook Who Sat by the Door, where our film goes through and has interviews with actors, directors, writers, anyone that had anything to do with the making of The Spook Who Sat by the Door. We did an interview with them, and we got them on the screen telling the true story of the repression of the spook.
So when you say the repression, what do you mean?
The film, once it came out in the movie theaters, it was repressed by the FBI and CIA.
The FBI and the CIA?
Yep. We have actual documents in the film saying that, you know, keep an eye out for Sam Greenlee. This film is too controversial. So we have all the FBI documents in the film. They repressed it. They destroyed it. It just recently came back out in 2004, and we're just trying to tell the story of the spook.
It is now conditioned, right? All fighters in the field.
We sort of tried Sidney's way, you know, being nice, but that's just not working.
Black people themselves were really hungry for a new image on the screen.
This movie is so political, and people seem to be trying to stop it so hard. This makes us gonna try even harder.
We were shooting in Gary because we couldn't get the permits to shoot in Chicago.
We had whole sections of neighborhoods and stuff blowing up and cars on fire.
We cut the action scene and the villa dancer scene, and we shopped it around until United Artists picked it up because they thought it was a blaxploitation film.
Blaxploitation, although controversial and contested in a lot of places, is pretty much apropos for the era.
It was commercial to the worst extent.
And you always had a black warlord, the main guy who everybody worked for, you know, it's like a mafia, you know. But this film was different. It's a film that had something to say.
This man entered with a plan and studied revolutionary and counter-revolutionary tactics and returned to Chicago to start the revolution.
Of course, that was at the height of, or at least the tail end of the COINTEL program, and I have no doubt whatsoever that there were people that kept up with that sort of thing.
There's a conversation that people are concerned that you might be having with the film.
Well, the 50 prints, all of them disappeared. But Ivan shrewdly put the negative into a vault under a different name, and they couldn't find that. That's how it survived.
And we'd say, yeah, man, you know, it was playing at this theater, and they just shut it down. And the next thing we knew, it was gone.
So much for the First Amendment.
context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, October 7th, 2016. So I have been told this is the book study session, and I'm not a big fan of just playing music for the sake of playing music, but I thought it would be a travesty to get through the book study session and Sam Greeley's 1969 masterpiece, The Spook Who Sat by the Door, and the film that he wrote the screenplay, was intricately involved in, that came out in 1973. Mr. Herbie Hancock did the soundtrack, amazing soundtrack for the film. I don't know if it's quite at the level of Curtis Mayfield and Superfly, but it's pretty close. The genius of Herbie Hancock. This is our fourth installment, The Spook Who Sat by the Door. We're picking up on Chapter 12, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number one. Chapter 12. It had been a harsh winter, the sub-zero temperatures a regular thing. There would be an occasional respite while the big, soft snow covered the city and, for a short time, covered the grime and dirt and ugliness of Chicago with its virginal whiteness. But within hours after the last flake fell, the virginal snow would be a greasy, dirt-grimed, whore-like snow, and then the temperature would drop and film the streets with mirror-like glaze, turning the city snow into something that crunched underfoot like an old cereal in a new box labeled Super and All New. There was nothing super and all new about Chicago, and it is not a place for people who concern themselves with the weather, winter or summer. The wind would whip in from the lake, bearing airborne razors of ice that sliced the flesh. There were regular gray skies and little sun. The sky seemed to sit just above the Tribune Tower, and it would sometimes descend to the city streets when the warm air masses moved up across the plains from the Gulf of Mexico to turn the city into a fog-bound, slushy swamp full of mud-splattered people who groped their way in the dense muck, mire, and moody, low-sitting cloud like amoebas in search of a guide to nowhere. When there was sun, it would come from afar in a hazy, cloudless sky, giving a harsh, cold, and biting light, the lack of clouds permitting what little warmth remained to flee toward the planets above, the people below creating little clouds of their own as they breathed and gasped, moving through the brutal city. Because the weather was so menacing, the cobras were not missed from their usual haunts, and there was no need to interrupt training by having some of the gang members on the block. It was too cold to be there, and the police and social workers did not worry where they might be, since the word was that the Cobras were no longer a bopping gang. And since lower-class Negroes are visible only when convenient or menacing, the Cobras disappeared and no one concerned themselves with what they might be doing that cold and forbidding winter. They were learning their lessons of the oppressed throughout history in striking back at their oppressors. The linguistics of deception, subterfuge, to strike when least expected and then fade into the background, to hound, harass, worry, and weaken the strong and whittle away at the strength and power that kept them where they were. Just before the rumble near the railroad tracks, the winter ended as abruptly as it had begun, and spring was in Chicago with no warning, the flowers blooming, the trees suddenly budding, the grass turning green, the dirty snow melting and disappearing into the sewers. Spring meant baseball and track, walks in the parks for young lovers, and examinations for the students reluctant to remain in the libraries and overheated apartments with textbooks that had become symbolic of the prison of a nasty Chicago winter. It was time for examinations for Freeman's small band of revolutionaries in training. They were becoming restless with the constant drills, the routines. They wanted to get it on. The rumble had convinced Freeman that they had not softened and that they could be counted on to follow orders. There were two more tests that were necessary, and the change in weather permitted them. Freeman continued to contribute to his playboy image, pretending to enjoy parties that bored him, dating women he did not like, flattering men he detested, doing and saying and acting things that sickened him. But there was never a hint that he was anything other than he appeared to be, and those of his committed friends who were now active in the movement and who remembered Freeman as a tireless firebrand in the struggle for civil rights now regarded him with contempt as a hopeless sellout. They stopped asking him to attend meetings, contribute to their campaigns, man their picket lines, or join their marches. They were his barometer, and he judged his performance by their personal reaction to him. The women thought him an eligible bachelor, if a bit of a chaser. The men thought him harmless and appreciated that he did not try to steal their women. Freeman thought that there was little to choose from among the black middle-class chicks available, and that risking the wrath of an insecure middle-class Negro whose only available test of manhood was confined to the boundaries of his bed was a waste of time and energy. Like Willie Loman, but for different reasons, it was important that Freeman be well-liked, and he was. He made speeches in the white suburbs concerning juvenile delinquency in the ghetto as the executive director of his foundation. He knew that his speeches were intended for entertainment rather than enlightenment, and he spiced them with the white man's statistics concerning Negro crime. He did not point out that Negro crime was largely confined to the ghetto because he knew those nice white people wanted to feel threatened by the nasty Negroes in the ghettos they never need see except in the picture magazines, on television, or when behind a mop, broom, or tray. He was urbane, witty, and fake informative. His Lotus was known over most of the South Side, and although he had to put on its hard top so as not to muss the hair or wigs of his dates, he enjoyed it very much as any part of his cover. He cultivated the police and politicians and the members of his board of directors. Freeman was constantly pointed out as an example of what a Negro could accomplish if he tried hard enough. He was considered an example of Negro progress, and no one concerned themselves with the increasing unemployment in the ghetto, the fact that Negroes continued to fall behind in national economic statistics. Freeman was a good salve for the non-existent conscience of the white man. That vacuum the editorials spoke of as having been aroused by the Negro revolt. Freeman told them what they wanted to hear and was just argumentative enough in cocktail parties to have whites refer to him as militant but responsible. Freeman was the best Tom in town. His cover was as good as it ever figured to be, and would probably not be blown before he could get his program underway. It was time to begin. He gathered his lieutenants at his apartment, plus a few other members of the Cobras, including Pretty Willie Dubois. This summer is the scene, but we need a few things first. Most of all, bread. We've been building up the war chest with what we've been stealing, plus whatever we make peddling shit in New York, but we don't have near enough. Sugar Hips, how we stand? We got a balance of $8,432.86. Right. That ain't enough for what we have to do, so we have to get more. We take it from Whitey and get it from where he keeps it. Freeman spread plans on his cocktail table. These are the floor plans for the bank in the shopping center on 115th and Halsted. We ought to be able to get a bit more than $100,000. They have a closed-circuit TV and automatic cameras, plus a very sophisticated alarm system. When they touch it off, it alerts the nearest precinct station, but makes no noise. There are only two guards, one on the floor, the other on a balcony above, behind one-way bulletproof glass with ports for firing to the floor below. But we hit the bank when it's crowded and he won't be able to fire for fear of hitting some innocent bystander. The only tight moment is when you move out and he might get a clear shot at you as you go through the door, but you'll move to the door with a couple of people as a shield, then shove them back in and make it. He'll be able to hear you up there and make it clear that if he starts firing at any time, you start wasting the crowd. It's a short hop to the Negro section in Princeton Park, and since it's all middle class nice, the cops are not likely to search it. That's where we hide out, in the house of Pretty Willie's mother, who's in New Orleans for the Mardi Gras. Besides, they're not going to be looking for niggers anyway, but for white men. They looked at him with curiosity. He drained his bottle of Carlsberg before he spoke. Pretty Willie leads it. He takes Red Beans, Benny Rooster, Pomani, and Pussyhead. They looked at one another and smiled, except Pretty Willie. Freeman had named the lightest colored members of the Cobras. "No, goddammit, I ain't white. I'm a nigger," said Willie. "Sure, baby, we know that. But that day, Whitey is going to think you're white. They'll be looking for everybody except us. Niggers don't rob banks, man. You know that. With a gun in your hand, telling Mr. Charlie what to do to give you his money? My man, you got to be white," said Dean. "Look, baby, you know we need the bread, and you know none of the rest of us can do it. They must not have more than 20 niggers with accounts there, and if 5 walk in at the same time, they're going to be suspicious. You the only one in the gang can do it, because although your soul is black, your skin is white," added Scott. "No," said Willie. "Man," said Stud, "don't you see how beautiful it is? I mean, you're turning him around. We all know you a nigger, and so does Whitey when you on the block with your skinny brim hat, hanging out with the cats. He never treats you any different from the rest of us. 'Cause you ain't black? Hell no. He gives you a harder time. Now you got a chance to turn it around." "No." Dean spoke up. "Turk, give us a chance to talk about it. Willie, you don't have to do it if you don't want to." He looked at Freeman for confirmation. Freeman nodded. "And nobody is going to put you down if you don't." He swept the room with hard eyes. "We all know you hung up about not being black, just like some hung up because they is black. So come on down to the pool room and we'll talk about it a little. You don't want to do it, you don't do it, and we do it some other way. Okay, Turk? Freeman nodded again. Crazy, let's split. Stud, you go see your old lady, because you might get bugged and want to get physical, and there ain't going to be no shit like that. Dig? Sides, I ain't sure you could whip Pretty Willie anyway. They all laughed and relaxed, including Willie and Stud. They were both good enough not to have to worry about the difference. They finished the beer, took the bottles into the kitchen, and filed out. 3 days later, Freeman received a call from Dean. Turk, they're all right. Pretty Willie will do it. Funny thing, he kinda happy about it now. Never seen the cat smile so much. Okay, come on by tonight. We'll need about 2 weeks to get it down pat, and it will have to be before the weather turns good. The worse, the better. It only took them 10 days of coaching to get the details right, but a warm air mass moved up from the Gulf and turned Chicago into a muddy, messy swamp of slush and snow that would freeze at night in the grotesque shapes that had been molded by tires during the day. They waited a week before the snow came again, and the temperature dropped swiftly one moonless night, hovering around zero and turning the icy streets into a glassy surface that sent cars spinning if braked too suddenly. The sky was a slate gray the next morning, seeming to hover just above the rooftops, heavy and leaden, threatening to fall on the ugly city below. They left for the shopping center at noon, by separate routes, and by that time, the temperature had risen and a fine, wind-blown snow slanted to cover the icy streets. Freeman drove a Mini Miner with Scandinavian ice tires on the front wheels, the front wheel drive gripping the ice firmly. It was modified to serve as a delivery truck for a small dry cleaners whose owner ate lunch at home and napped afterward. They had timed him and he never returned to work before 3 in the afternoon. They had stolen the car and changed the front tires. Freeman drove alone into the big parking lot not more than 100 yards from the bank. The others arrived in a Willie's station wagon, its four-wheel drive giving it stability on the icy streets. Freeman watched as they approached the bank separately. He could see into the bank through the big glass doors. There were about 3 dozen people inside, other than the employees. Not many, but enough. He watched Pretty Willie walk in last and without hesitation pull his gun. Mouths opened to scream and shout, but no sound reached Freeman outside. They had been lucky, and one of the guards was at lunch. The other reached for his gun, and Willie dropped him with a bullet in the thigh. Monty was the closest to the guard. He kicked his gun away and then kicked him in the head until he lay quiet. Two of the others vaulted the cashier's counter and began stuffing money into canvas laundry bags. Willie watched the ports above for the sign of a gun barrel, unaware that the guard was absent. No one else moved. First Pussyhead, then Rooster moved from around the counter, bags full of money in each hand. Freeman started the car and wheeled swiftly in front of the bank, the back of the small truck towards the doors. They moved out of the bank and into the truck, and Freeman drove off quickly. Dean across the street and using the hood of the Willie's wagon as a gun rest, fired a deer rifle with scope sights high into the glass doors, pinning the occupants to the floor. He emptied the chamber and got into the truck, following the Mini North on Halstead. Freeman drove to 95th and turned east, coming to rest in front of Willie's house after zigzagging to it from 5 blocks away. They moved swiftly into the house with the money, and he drove away and left the car in a residential neighborhood and was picked up by Stud Davis in another car. They had left the stolen Mini in a white neighborhood. In 15 minutes, Freeman was home sipping 12-year-old scotch, waiting for the bathtub to fill with very hot water. Later that evening, he watched the news on television and heard the announcer describe the daring daylight robbery of the bank. They were all listed as Caucasian in the police description of the bandits. Freeman smiled. A nigger with a gun in a bank with a lot of money had to be white because niggers snatched purses and rolled drunks. Any cop could tell you that. They just didn't rob banks. Freeman now had an army and a treasury. He needed an arsenal, and he knew where he could get that. Then he could start messing with white folks. Spring came early as if an apology for the fierce winter, the sun bright in pale blue skies, fat white clouds floating overhead, the ore boats moving lazily to the steel mills at the lake's southern tip. The buds burst, the city turned green, and the grime did not seem so noticeable. The noise of the L not so annoying, the stench of the fumes from the buses not so poisonous. For a few days in spring and fall, Chicago seemed almost fit for human habitation. Baseballs, footballs, basketballs filled the air in the ghetto, the spherical symbols of a possible escape from the ghetto cage. The junkies stood and sat in the warm sun, their dope-filled blood moving sluggishly in their veins, the ugly world taking on a warm glow, everything soft and pretty prior to their moving through the streets at night looking for loot to support their habit. The winos drank their sweet wine beneath the L tracks, their hoarse voices rising with laughter as the sweet alcohol filled them. The unemployed, who still stubbornly hoped were in the loop and at the factories on the periphery of the city looking for jobs that did not exist. Their more realistic black brothers stood and joked in front of the pool rooms, sat in front of countless TV sets in countless bars, or drank beer from quart bottles in paper bags. The squad cars moved slowly through the ghetto, stopping here and there to collect their graft. Whores arose, dressed, and moved into the unfamiliar sunlight toward a restaurant and late afternoon breakfast. Whites moved through the ghetto like maggots on a carcass. Cops, social workers, school teachers, bill collectors, the supervisors and collectors of the syndicate, the owners of taverns, furniture stores, currency exchanges, television stores. The ghetto moved into the streets from the hovels where they had huddled during the winter, where they would stay until the Chicago cold forced them to return to their small, smelly rooms for another winter. They moved through Washington Park on a cool, moonless night toward the big National Guard armory that stood on Cottage Grove Avenue on the park side. Freeman led 2 strike teams of 5 each. Stud Davis in charge of 1, Pretty Willie heading the 2nd, Dean as Freeman's 2nd in command. There was a wire fence separating the armory from the park. They scaled the fence easily. Freeman motioned to Stud, and Davis and 3 others moved silently toward the board guard. There would be 2 guards walking the armory perimeter and 4 more inside for relief. They were regular army, their commander, a master sergeant who drove home to Winnetka along the outer drive each night. The first heard nothing right up until the time he was grabbed from behind and borne to the ground by Stud. The second turned his head before he was hit, but had no time to yell. The rest were simply locked in the guard room, bound and gagged after being confronted by the silent men with their faces covered by nylon stockings. Freeman forced the lock on the room holding the arms. He had chosen this armory because it was a white unit in the segregated Illinois Guard, and they figured to have more modern equipment than in either of the Negro armories. He found that they were in luck, and in addition to M1s, there were grease guns, Colt 45 automatics, and ammunition for both. Fragmentation, smoke, and tear gas grenades, grenade launchers, gas masks, four Springfield .03 sniper rifles with scopes and ammo for them, eight bazookas, and rockets. He was disappointed to find no plastic explosives, only TNT and detonators, but it was better than nothing. He moved through the room, indicating what should be moved into the yard outside the armory. He chose a grease gun, slipped a full magazine into it, jacked a round into the chamber, and slipped the safety on. He waited outside, the gun at the ready, while his men moved the arms and ammunition. The empty green and white CTA bus blinked its lights two blocks away, and he motioned to Pretty Willie to open the gates on the Cottage Grove side of the building. The bus was driven by a Cobra. It took less than 20 minutes to load the bus, and since a CTA garage was less than three blocks south of the armory on Cottage Grove, no one thought it strange to see an empty bus on the street. Within an hour, the arms and ammunition were cached, and Freeman was ready. He needed only wait for the hot, humid summer and an arrogant, head-whipping cop to spark the riots. It was like waiting for the sun to shine in the Sahara Desert. Freeman did not think that there would be much searching of the ghetto for the arms because niggers didn't steal government property and defy the FBI any more than they robbed banks. Chapter 13. Spring ended abruptly. A hot, moist air mass moved up from the Gulf of Mexico across the plains and into Chicago, smothering the city and turning the night into a furnace, the brick buildings radiating the heat collected from the sun during the day. Life in the ghetto moved outside onto the doorsteps of the houses, into the air-conditioned bars and the cinemas that sold cool air and the Doris Daydreams. On the south side, there was Washington Park, and families moved at night into its cool greenness, sleeping on blankets under the stars until the first rays of sun, returning to their stifling rooms to snatch a few more minutes of sleep before meeting the hot, humid day. Beer, watermelon, ice cream, anything cool, but there was no way to leave the engulfing heat. The city lay gasping like a big beast. Tempers shortened, and the ghetto lay like a bomb waiting to explode. Freeman thought that it would begin on the west side, but it began on the south side, not far from his home. A cop killed a 15-year-old boy beneath the L tracks near 50th Street. A group of them had been drinking beer when the cop ordered them on. Someone threw a brick, and the policeman drew his gun. He claimed that the boy advanced with a knife. Others disputed his claim, but for the neighborhood, the dispute became irrelevant. The word of the shooting spread, and the streets filled with people. the wails of sirens sounded as riot-trained police sped to the area. Freeman's phone rang. "Turk, this is Sugar. Daddy said to tell you it looked like it's going to begin. They got people in the street." "Right. Where are you?" "In the pool room." "Stay there until you hear from me. I'll call back in about an hour." He called his office and told the girl on night duty to alert his street workers and said that he would call again within the hour. He got into his car and headed for 51st Street. He walked up to a squad roll and spoke to a cop he had known in high school. "Hi, Bill. How does it look?" "Hey, Dan. Not too good. Young cop panicked and burned a kid, and people are bugged. You know what happens when you have this kind of heat for this long. Anything will touch them off. We got cops moving around in there now, spades in plain clothes, telling them to cool it and to go home. It's the kids I'm worried about. If they get started, it could spread. Anything I can do to help? You know some of the kids around here, don't you? Tell me you pretty tight with the Cobras." "Yeah, I know them." "Well, one of your street workers is in there already. It wouldn't hurt if you went in too. But get the hell out if it looks bad. We don't need any heroes." "You think it might get bad?" "I hope not, but I think so. These people wouldn't spend 10 minutes in a picket line, but they'd fight all night. We've been lucky so far, but you know Chicago. If it really goes, it will make all the other riots look like picnics." "Okay, Bill. I'll see what I can do." "Get the hell out of there if they start raising hell, and check back with me every now and then. Dawson is in charge there. You know him." "Right. Take it easy, man." "I just hope the brothers take it easy. Rioting won't help things any." "The picket lines don't seem to have helped much either." "Yeah, and that's the bitch of it." Freeman walked down Indiana Avenue. People milled about in the streets. The jitneys had stopped making their runs up and down the streets and were either elsewhere or parked on side streets. He had noticed signs already in the windows indicating which stores were Negro-owned. Plainclothes police moved through the crowds, softly urging the people to return to their homes. Here and there, men harangued knots of listeners about Whitey and police brutality. The police were particularly nervous about rioting on the South Side because it was not a solid ghetto. There were whites in the big housing development near the hospital on 31st Street, which had replaced the slums there as part of urban renewal, and it was separated from the Negroes by only the broadness of South Park Boulevard. There were whites a short distance away in Hyde Park. Rioting would not be easy to contain and might entail more than just burning of stores and buildings. Freeman moved through the crowds, listening and trying to gauge their mood. There was a chance that they might cool off and return to their homes. There was also a chance that they might explode any minute. He spotted Stud Davis and walked toward him. "Hey, Stud, what's happening?" "Nothing shaking, man." They walked out into the street, away from the crowds. "You been to the pool room?" "Yeah. Daddy, Hips, and Pretty Willie's there." "Where are the rest?" "Out in the street, like the plan." "You think they'll blow?" "Yeah, and I don't even think we'll have to start it. Some of the younger kids are ready to start raising hell. If a cop start leaning on somebody, it's gonna blow. But the fuzz been real cool so far."
"You seen my street worker?"
"Perkins?" "Yeah. He was around here a few minutes ago. I think he's in the next block. I think he kind of scared." "Yeah? Well, so am I." "Cool it." He walked down the block, feeling the tension in the air, the look of expectancy everywhere on the faces of the people, children, the cops. The cops were seasoned veterans, no rookies, and they would not act hastily. They had kept the white cops on the periphery. Freeman turned west and then south and walked back to 51st Street. The cops had ordered the bars and liquor stores closed. The whites who owned businesses had faded into the night, and the only white faces on the street were those of the police. Freeman was told to move on several times by nervous cops and had to show his identification twice as he strolled down the street toward the east, watching the police in riot helmets and the angry faces of the crowd. Everyone waited for something to happen. Television crews moved here and there with handheld cameras and cameras mounted on the roof of their equipment trucks, their bright lights giving a harsh glare and casting grotesque shadows. The blue lights on top of the squad cars revolved and winked every few yards. Gas masks were distributed and boxes of tear gas canisters opened. Ambulances and paddy wagons stood at the ready. Cops spoke busily into their car radios and handy talkies. Everywhere they clutched their nightsticks tightly like magic wands, which would give them strength, beauty, and power. The smells were there. Barbecue, fried chicken, fried shrimps, greens, beans, and cornbread. But the sounds of the ghetto were not there. The jukeboxes silent and no soul music from inside the bars and restaurants, barbecue joints, or from the loudspeakers hung outside the record store. None of the laughter, shouts to friends, the teasing arguments, or quick staccato bursts of angry profanity, no whistling, humming, or someone singing to themselves. The clatter of the L was present as it moved south toward Inglewood or Jackson Park stations, or north to Howard Street. But otherwise, there were alien sounds, the crackle of the police radios and handy-talkies, the disembodied voices over bullhorns, the sullen murmur of the milling crowds, and the keening songs of hate by the street speakers. The air hung hot and heavy, and there was no hint of a sudden rain to break the heat wave. Freeman turned north on Indiana Avenue for the second time that night and approached Perkins, his street worker, who was talking to Detective Sergeant Pete Dawson. "Hey, Dawson, Perk, how do things look?" "Not good," said Dawson. "It could blow any minute, or maybe not. We hope we can keep it sealed off if it does go. We're keeping the white cops out of here for now. The cat that wasted the kid was O'Fay. He didn't have any choice. The kid came at him with a knife. It was self-defense." He sounded as if he were trying to convince himself more than Freeman and Perkins. They all knew that the cop had emptied his gun and missed only once. Standard procedure was to try and drop an assailant with a shot in the thigh or leg. Dawson shook his head. The cop shouldn't have gone into that dark alley alone. He's new down here. He's used to having people respect the uniform. We keep them moving, but as soon as we break up one group, another forms in the next block. This heat is a bitch. Maybe they'll run out of energy and go home. They looked at one another. They all knew that it was hotter in those buildings than in the street. "Anything we can do, Dawson, to help?" "Just what you've been doing. Tell the kids to cool it. They'll listen to you and Perk. I don't think there will be any head whipping. The cops in here have orders, and they're all pretty cool. Tough, but cool, and the people here know how far they can push them." Freeman turned to Perkins. How does it look to you, Perk? Kids nervous? Yeah, everybody but the Cobras. They seem to take the whole thing as some kind of joke. They're sitting around in small groups, cooling it. Stud Davis is on the block. The other leaders seem to be shooting pool. They're on junk, said Dawson. Junkies don't care about this kind of scene. What about the others, Perk? Well, the Bearcats are out in force, but I don't think they'll start anything, although they might join in if something starts. But the Apaches might start trouble. They'd like to take over from the Cobras, and I've seen a few Comanches around. Not many, though, since they sealed off the area. Okay, Perk. First, get down to the drugstore and phone the office. Get the rest of the street workers down here. Then keep moving around. Keep in close touch with the Apaches, with their leaders. Tell them to cool it. I'll be around. He turned to Dawson. Take it easy, baby. Yeah, man. Nothing else to do. He walked off down the street. Freeman moved among them, talking to them, listening sympathetically to their angry protests. He soothed them and told them to go home, that rioting would do no one any good, and he did not shuck. You either work at a cover or forget it. And he did not feel that he would have to do anything to start the thing. He knew if not tonight, there would be some other night like this one. Whitey was stupid and stubborn about Negroes. He would not believe that Negroes would not continue to passively accept the pushing around that whites had come to think of as their birthright. The white cops on 51st Street, he knew, felt that all they had to do was to charge the people here, make enough arrests of the ringleaders, bloody enough heads, a bit of tear gas, guns fired overhead, and if need be, shoot a few niggers, and they would tuck their tails between their legs and become silent and invisible once more. They would not believe that things had changed and that these people had had enough. They listened to Freeman because they trusted him, although they did not agree with what he was saying that night because they were too angry and frustrated. They remembered now the waiting in vain for jobs that never materialized, the long humiliating lines to sign the papers thrust at them by arrogant clerks at the unemployment compensation office, the slights and insults of the social workers, the welfare raids on their women's rooms in the middle of the night in an effort to catch a man there. The streets seemed hotter, dirtier, uglier, smellier than they had ever been, and no one seemed to care. But tonight they cared. Tonight these people were not invisible. Tonight Whitey knew they existed, and there were among them those who wanted Whitey to remember this night for years to come. A bit after midnight, they began to cool down, some to drift to their small, hot rooms for a beer and the late show on TV. The Negro cops in their midst sensed the change with relief, and then it happened. It was the dogs. The truck with the four dogs and their handlers was to have been parked outside the area to be used only on orders from the commander of the riot task force. But someone made a mistake and the truck stopped at the intersection of 51st and Indiana Avenue. The commander had left his command post there to check the roadblock at South Park. One of the dog handlers approached a captain of police. Hello, Captain. We just brought the dogs down. You want us to go in? Well, the commandant and the second in command aren't here right now. I don't know. How are things so far? Well, They got the colored cops in there, been in for a few hours, been kind of tense, but nothing big so far. They're trying to use persuasion. His mouth twisted at the word. Things have sure changed since I joined the force. All this scientific crap the new commissioner put in. Hell, we can't fart if a computer don't say so. Send 3 squads of big Irish cops in there, a little tear gas, and we can all go home and have a beer. Maybe they can use us in there, Captain. These dogs will move them. Never seen it fail. Yep, one thing a nigger is scared of is a dog. Go ahead in, but you better report to Dawson. He's a shine detective lieutenant. Thinks he's hell on wheels because he's got some college degree. You don't report to him, he'll be complaining to the chief. I'm special duty attached to headquarters downtown. I don't have to worry about no jig lieutenants. He walked away to the van, a big man who carried his vast belly well, like a pro tackle in his last years, using his bulk and experience to add a few more seasons toward his pension. He motioned to the others, and they opened the van carefully, first talking to the dogs to calm them, and then in fierce command voices, ordering them one by one to the pavement to attach the leashes and remove the muzzles. There were 3 dark Alsatians and a Doberman. The other cops watched them with interest, and the Negro police with flat expressions that said nothing. The big cop in charge of the detail checked to see that they were ready and adjusted his riot helmet, then drew his club. They advanced across the intersection, 4 abreast, and north into Indiana Avenue. It was very quiet now, the eyes of the cops on the dogs and the noise of an L going south from the station a short distance away echoed loudly through the streets. They moved down the street the short distance in which the shops curled briefly around the corner before stopping abruptly where the residential section of the block began. The people on the porches and steps of the buildings saw them first. The others in the streets turned at their shouts. They bringing dogs in! Dogs! They bringing dogs in! The cry was picked up and traveled quickly down the block. The cops continued to advance slowly, 4 abreast, the dogs straining on their leashes. Oh, fake cops with dogs! What the hell they think this is? Alabama? When they going to get the cattle prods and bull whips? Some of the people on the steps of the building flanking the street disappeared into the hallway, making their way to the garbage cans on the back porches, searching them for bottles, going into the backyards and alleys to look for bricks. The people in the street moved back slowly before the advancing 4. Get them, motherfuckers! This ain't Birmingham! No goddamn dogs here! Get 'em! The first bottle came from a porch, then another from a window on the second floor of a building. They shattered close to the 4 cops and their straining, snarling dogs. At a signal from the big cop, they advanced a few yards at a run, scattering the people in the street before them. All right, get back. You people, break it up. Go on home now. Move it. A volley of bricks and bottles answered him. One young black boy stood silently on the sidewalk, not moving. The cop opposite him moved toward him, and the Doberman started tearing at his pants legs. The cop ordered the dog off, and the boy moved away, but slowly, a look of contempt on his face as he looked the cop in the eye. He had never taken his eyes off the face of the policeman, even as the dog lunged at him. He moved away now, watching the cop with that look, his right pants leg in tatters. The people moved back into the street as the 4 moved past, and they were surrounded now, with a space between them and the black angry faces that retreated before them, the black faces that followed to their rear. It was not according to the book. There should be cops to their rear to ensure that the cleared streets remain so, but they were in now and the big cop was stubborn and unafraid. He moved on, holding the big dog easily, his club at the ready, ignoring the missiles thrown at him. If they moved within the prescribed distance, he would order the dog to attack. He moved ahead, staring at them steadily from beneath the visor of his riot helmet, ignoring the shouts, insults, bricks, and bottles. Suddenly, someone thrust himself through the crowd, and he had to order the dog to relax as he recognized the shield of a sergeant of detectives. "What the hell are you doing in here with those damn dogs?" shouted Dawson. "I'm doing my job, that's what," the big cop retorted hotly. "I'm trying to help you. Whose side you on, anyway?" "Get those dogs out of here right now. Don't you know what dogs mean to these people?" "The captain told me to bring them in," he responded stubbornly. "Well, I'm telling you to get them out. I'm in charge here. Where the hell is the chief?" "He said no dogs." "I don't know where the chief is, and I got my orders." Dawson drew his pistol from his belt holder. "If you don't move them, you're going to have some dead dogs on your hands." He moved back and aimed at the animal. Four other Negro detectives had appeared. They drew their weapons. The big cop looked at them with hate. "Okay, we're going. But you'll hear from headquarters about this. Pulling a gun on a brother officer." Dawson looked at him and said softly, "You're not my brother, buddy." He turned to the crowd as the uniformed police turned about and headed south toward 51st Street with their dogs. "It's okay now. The dogs are leaving. They're going back. Cool it now. Go on home." But it was too late, and Dawson sensed it. The bottles continued to fly, the voices loud in rage. "They brought the dogs in just like in Birmingham. It'll be the fire hoses and cattle prods next. They don't give a shit. It's the same damn thing anywhere if you're black." One of the dogs bit a child, a 3-year-old girl. She bleeding something awful. They got her in an ambulance and won't let her mother near her. The bastards. The word spread quickly about the dogs, and hundreds of people converged on the street between 51st and 50th. Dawson and his men moved among them, the crowd jostling some, and occasionally they had to strike back. Reluctantly, Dawson fired a red flare, the signal to rendezvous prior to pulling out. He had his men move the crowd back by force, creating a circle 20 feet in diameter. "Dan, we're moving back as soon as all my men are here. We'll probably have to move the uniformed cops in now. I don't know if we can snuff it out, but we'll have to charge them. Talking's no good anymore. The dogs finished that." "I can't leave without Perkins, Dawes. It's all right. You're not responsible. I think it will be okay for another few minutes as long as they don't mistake me for a cop." He saw Perkins move quickly into the circle, his face drawn and worried. "Shit, Dan, they were going home. They were going home. It was going to be fine until they brought them dogs in. It was going to be just fine." He fought back tears, his face full of exhaustion. They formed a diamond pattern and forced their way back down the block, striking out when they had to, taking no joy in it. They would have to crack a lot of heads tonight, they knew, and except for the sadist and power-hungry among them, they took no pride in attacking their own people. Finally, they made it to the barricades on the corner and moved through them. The jeering crowd stopped a short distance away, filling the street. The detectives slumped against police cars and vans. Some sat on curbs, perspiration dripping from their faces, drenching their clothes. The police stirred nervously, fingering their weapons, their boredom gone. Dawson strode to his car and yanked the microphone from the dash. Baker 4 to Baker 1. Baker 4 to Baker 1. Come in, Baker 1. Over. This is Baker 1. Baker 4. This is Baker 1. Baker 4. I read you. Over. Better get back here, Chief. Looks like it's gonna be bad. Over. What happened? I thought things were quieting down. Over. They were. It was almost finished. Then they brought the dogs in. You know what they think about dogs. Over. He looked very tired. Someone handed him a cup of coffee in a paper cup. There was a pause and the radio hummed. Okay, Pete. Hold on. I'll be right there. You at the CP? Over. Yeah, Chief. You better hurry. Over. Right. We're on our way now. Out. Dawson could hear the scream of the siren approaching from the east. He looked up at the man who had handed him the coffee. Well, Dan, we did what we could. Yeah, Dawes. Dawson looked over the barricades at the angry mob. He knew many of them. He had lived for years within blocks of here. He knew their anger and their pain. But there was nothing he could do. He was a cop. He would have a very busy night. You know, Dan, they were going home. Another hour, and you could have been in the Boulevard Lounge tasting and those people at home. Now look at it. This could be the worst yet. I've never seen them like that before. Why did they bring those dogs in? Why, man? Don't they know how they feel about dogs? How come they so stupid? Everything was cool and they had to mess it up. Why do they always mess it up? I don't know, Dawes, but they always do. Context of white supremacy. First audio segment, all done. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you have a question, commentary. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you want to call but you don't want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.ty.cc/oneRace. And that is the number 1. Address again, tiny.ty.cc/oneRace. And that is the number 1. When you put the address in, click the link on the left of the page. It says free VOPE line. Click it. It will open a small window on your screen. the first line. It is a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code, again, is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can use your real name. You can use a nickname. You can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that entered, click the green button at the bottom to call. You will hear us live once you dial in. It's the same procedure. If you would like to participate, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. You will hear the audio prompt. Press 1, and we will get you on the line. I have one quick comment and then two questions that you can incorporate into your responses as we go. My one mention would be, I think, worth investigating. I'm going to see if I can get in contact with them myself. The documentary film Infiltrating Hollywood, The Rise and Fall of the Spook Who Sat by the Door, where they talk to a lot of the actors. They talk to Sam Greenlee and others who were associated with the film, what the response of the film was, the suppression of the film. Really, I didn't even know about it until this week. I was, you know, just spending a little bit of time researching the whole project and everything. But it's, the documentary is Infiltrating Hollywood, The Rise and Fall of the Spook Who Sat by the Door. That's one. That's my comment. So my two questions. Question for anyone. Any similarities in The Spook Who Sat by the Door and the film that was released this week, Nate Parker? The Birth of a Nation, Nate Parker's The Birth of a Nation. Any similarities between these two projects? You can incorporate that in your responses as we go. Question specifically for Thomas in New York. Is Pete Dawson white? That's specifically for Thomas in New York. He's given his theory before about black. If you are a black enforcement official, you are white. Is Pete Dawson white? If you dialed in and have commentary, lines should be open. Feel free to share your thoughts.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I'm glad you asked me that question, because the whole time that section was being read, I was cracking up, thinking, man, and in my response, what I was going to, I wrote down, is in a time when we have a cop, black cop, throwing a taser by a black man after a white cop shot him in the back 5 times, and a black cop to Charlotte saying they shot a man when it's obvious a white man shot him. Police back then must have been totally different than they are today. And that was what I was going to say, because today there's no Pete Dawson. Was it Pete Dawson? It's no Officer Dawson's that I've encountered today at all. They seem to be very compliant with the, they would have been, man, how come y'all didn't bring any dogs in here for us to walk around with too? That's how they would be today. That's my opinion. And I'm doing my line over. The reading this week was great. I was traveling, so I didn't have the book in front of me. Just seems like they're being very codified. They're laying out their plan, and you know, and like clockwork, you know, they're very predictable. White people, you kind of know that it's gonna be that white cop. That's, hey man, we waiting around for these are niggas. Let's just go in there with the dogs and go get a beer afterwards, you know? So it just seems very accurate, except for the fact that Officer Dawson, I cracked up at that role in the movie, too, don't exist.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you guys. Greetings to Thomas in New York and all the other callers and listeners. Yeah, this book reading is very, very interesting, and I must agree with Thomas in New York. Pete Dawson doesn't exist in our world today. I just think the time at that particular time, I would say probably in the 60s and prior to, essentially, even though black men, they still had an understanding, and it's probably due to the revolutionary struggle that blacks were going through during that time, they had a better understanding of the fact that they were essentially working with the enemy. And I think a lot of people like Mr. Dawson, Officer Dawson, is like my father-in-law, because when his family had gone through the brutality of the Trenton Six incident in the state of New Jersey, that's what prompted him to want to be an officer himself, because he felt that he could change the system from within. And I believe that Pete Dawson was of that ilk. I totally agree with Thomas in New York that in today's day and age, I believe that black officers are so invested in white supremacy and the power of white people, and they want that white validation on such a high level. And white people have successfully confused and obfuscated the reality of the system that we're dealing with, that those black officers are much more invested in the system of white supremacy than back when this book was written. To get into this reading, which is really great, Sam Greenlee starts on page 139. He writes, "Look, baby, you know we need the bread, and you know none of the rest of us can do it. They must not have more than 20 niggas with accounts there. And if 5 walk in at the same time, they're going to be suspicious. You're the only one in the gang that can do it, because although your soul is black, your skin is white," added Scott. And I find this line very telling. It deals with colorism within our people and how we tend to look at shade. And Willie's deep feelings of lack of melanin being an issue as far as him being viewed as a black person. And it really reminded me of Dr. Ben's book. It's called Black Men of the Nile and His Family, where he provides images of indigenous African people from all over the continent. And there are some in those images that would look like white people. And he specifically did it probably for the same reason that Sam Greenlee has allowed colorism to play out in the book the way that it has. And it's just to help us to solidify the understanding that black people come in all colors and shades, because we are the origins of all these other people. We are the parent people, as Dr. Wilson would say. And the damages that white supremacy has put on us, to the point where us darker skinned black people go through the trouble and the torture of making those of us who are lighter skinned feel like they're less black or less African or less connected to us simply because of that issue. They had no control over what happened to their ancestors to allow them to become the light skinned black people that they are. And that's something that should be understood, and we should not squabble amongst ourselves, like Dr. Wilson would say. The next thing I wanted to touch on was on, here we go. It's on page 148, where Mr. Freeman writes, "Hey, Dan, not too good. Young cop panicked and burned the kid, and people are bugged. You know what happens when you have this kind of heat for long? Anything will touch them off. We got cops moving around in their nav, spades and plain clothes, telling them to cool it and go home. It's the kids I'm worried about. If they get started, it could spread." And this reminds me of what I discussed. I think it was either the last book reading or the previous one before that, when I was talking about Dan's discussion of the fact that he had 25 million family members. In other words, he had a Pan-African view, which I totally agree with. And I spoke about the fact that even though you would have quite a number of black people who would not be involved in the revolutionary struggle, if that was to jump off as far as a physical struggle, once the struggle takes off and other people who previously were not involved gets wind of it, it would become contagious. And I believe that that's exactly what he's speaking about. And especially when you're dealing with young people, because young people take a lot less time to get fed up, and they take a lot less time to want to do something right then and there. Like you always say, replace white supremacy with justice immediately. I believe it's those of us who have spent a little more time on the planet who condition ourselves to believe that things cannot change in our lifetime. And like I said before, just like President Obama was, elected basically overnight, and we had no idea that it would happen. The vast majority of us never thought it would. The same thing could happen with the system if we get it together and make it happen as far as educating our people as to what the system is and how it works. The other thing I wanted to touch on was, it's on page 153. listening sympathetically to their angry protests. He soothed them and told them to go home, that rioting would not do no one any good, and he did not shuck. You either work at the cover or forget it. And he did not feel that he would have to do do anything to start this thing. He knew if not tonight, there would be some other night like this. Whitey was stupid and stubborn about Negroes. He would not believe that Negroes would not continue to passively accept the pushing around that whites had come to think of as their birthright. The white cops on 51st, he knew. He felt that all they had to do was charge the people here, make enough arrests of the ringleaders, bloody enough heads, a bit of tear gas, guns fired overhead, and if need be, shoot a few niggas. And they would tuck their tails between their legs, become silent and invisible once more. They would not believe that things had changed and that these people had had enough. And I believe that this is exactly what we see today, as far as just the way white people have been conditioned, whether it's George Floyd to any rogue cop name that is of the white persuasion or black persuasion or any other color for that matter. Essentially, they just have this idea that we're conditioned to in this passive sort of scenario and that nothing will change. And I think that white people's belief in their superiority to the point that they do have us conditioned like we are is something we can use to our advantage if we were in a clandestine way to reach enough people to help them understand the system and they themselves want to do something about it, united, independent. If that just that understanding could spread, we could spread that amongst our people like proverbial wildfire, then when we did decide to do something about it, they would come with this sort of mentality, and that would give us the real opportunity to turn this around once and for all if we were to take advantage of that. There's only two more things, and then I'll shut my mouth. The next section I wanted to touch on was on page 158, where he writes, Dawson drew his pistol from the belt holder. If you don't move them, you're going to have some dead dogs on your hands. He moved back and aimed at the animal. Four other Negro detectives appeared. They cop looked at them with hate. Okay, we're going, but you'll hear from headquarters about this, pulling the gun on a brother officer. Dawson looked at him and said softly, you are not my brother, buddy. He turned to the crowd as the uniformed police turned about and headed south toward 51st Street with their dogs. And I found this very interesting. I remember Scotty Reed, actually brought this up in the last book study, I believe, or the one before that, where he discussed the military aspect of the book and the fact that, you know, he asked a question to those in the military that were on the line as to what would they do if they were ordered to shoot down their own people in a situation where there was a standoff between the police and the National Guard or the police. The people and the National Guard or the people and the police, what would you do about that? Would you take those orders and act on them, or would you turn the guns on the people giving the orders? And what I find is that this mentality would only come from police officers who understand the system of white supremacy in that way, where they realize even though they're police officers, they're still black, and they're also trying to avoid carnage as far as getting innocent black people hurt. So they're taking the approach that I believe is the correct counter-racist approach. And if with this, we could have enough officers in the police, the law enforcement system that think like this, we would have a lot less issues, I think, in regards to some of the stuff that we see happening. So I would hope that that would happen. And the last thing I wanted to touch on was on page 161, where he writes, you know, Dan, they were going home. Another hour and you could have been in the Boulevard Lounge tasting, and those people at home. Now look at it. This could be the worst yet. I've never seen them like that before. Why did they bring those dogs in? Why, man? Don't they know how they feel about dogs? How come they so stupid? Everything was cool and they had to mess it up. Why do they always have to mess it up? I don't know, Dawes, but they always do. And I find that just very, very interesting, simply because in that moment, Dawes really doesn't understand the system of white supremacy with that statement in particular, because if he did understand it, white people being in this supreme position gives them an arrogance. And that arrogance was just what Thomas alluded to before, where he heads over, you know, get the niggas in check and it's going to be all right. We'll go back home and have some beers and kick it. And when you understand, when he, if he understood that that is the way white people function at all times, then he would understand that they like violence. That is their culture. That is their religion. They love to kill black people. That is their religion. And that is why they would do something that would adversely affect those people to make them act out in a violent manner so that they could violently suppress them and have an excuse to basically just go as wild as possible as far as taking as much black life as they can. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Retired firefighter, did you have a commentary you were going to share, sir?
Yes, sir. Greetings, everyone. Few points. Let me see what the first one. As far as my thoughts with Mr. Greenlee and the book and the movie, the only thing, in my opinion, that's fictional is the actual story itself. We know it didn't actually happen, but he seems to be, and that's why it was so effective to capture my attention. I think he stayed in the line of reality with racism, white supremacy, and our attempts to counter racism. That's what makes the movie and the book interesting and constructive. Black police officers, for the most part, the rise of them as far as black males becoming employed as enforcement officials, I would say, I could be wrong, but I would say really started happening in and around after the 1940s, after World War II. Most of these individuals were veterans in the military, with going through all of that training and we're talking about 1950s with the Korean War, what is called the Korean War, and also with Vietnam. Matter of fact, I have a cousin that was a Vietnam veteran that was an enforcement official that retired from City of Miami Police Department. That's where I would say the majority, as far as origins are concerned. Now, in places like New York, they I'm sure they had some enforcement officials even before that period of time, and a few other places. But for the most part, that's where a lot of non-white black enforcement officials came from. They were in the military. They were trained physically as well as mentally. since the dog subject has come up, like trained dogs in a sense, to whereas they're not going to, and a trained dog is trained not to disagree with their master. Although they are victims of racism, white supremacy, I'm just saying it from a standpoint of how I see it on a raw basis. Well trained in that light. I have sat around with a few over the years when I was employed with Dade County Fire Department. The two agencies work close together. Most cases, you go on calls, especially if they're an emergency enough or bad enough, the police are going to be there. And so you develop a relation and know people in that light. The technology, even in criminal, quote unquote, criminal activity, whites who commit, the obvious, I mean, white supremacy is crime itself, but, from a standpoint of what is called felonies and whatnot, whites have always, who were the quote unquote criminals, from a standpoint of what is obviously to most people is called criminal activity. They've always matched the whites who pretended that they weren't criminals, but actually were. I matched them. There was always threats. You know, we know about during the 30s with the Bonnie and Clydes, the Machine Gun Kellys and whatnot. It was a threat to each other, and it's still out of date. White people like that are, that disagree with other white people. But non-white black people have always been behind the technology for that day. For the more, even back during that, during the time where he speaks about the weaponry, black people didn't have access to that matched white people as far as automatic weapons, semi-automatic weapons. They have it today, but they're kind of like obsolete to the military today, as far as that concern. I'm trying to relate it to the book and movie itself. I may be ahead as far as the it hasn't gotten to that part where they actually got into combat with the quote unquote white establishment in with the book. Probably haven't, but it hasn't matched it. We have never matched them as far as that concern. I can remember Ms. Farrakhan stating that the white man would give you a gun because he knows you're not going to shoot him. But the technology level with us has always been behind, and that's done on purpose, of course. So these are just some of my observations as far as the book reading. I've been kind of like going behind because I haven't been able to share live with the book, but I've been going through some of the archives on it, and those are my observations. Thank you.
For sure, for sure. If other folks have commentary, please don't wait till the last minute. We have a little less than 30 minutes before we get to the second audio segment. If you have anything that you would like to share. Some of the comments... Thank you. Some of the comments I wanted to make sure I got in. Nobody commented on any comparison to Nate Parker. Maybe that was the comment, that nobody sees a correlation. I'll maybe share a thought on that down the road. In terms of the actual text, at the very beginning of this week's reading, when he's talking about the weather in Chicago, that there would be an occasional respite while the big soft snow covered the city and for a short time covered the grime and dirt and ugliness of Chicago with its virginal whiteness, but within hours after the last flake fell, the virginal snow would be a greasy, dirt-grimed, whore-like snow, and it just goes on from there. I thought that is the type of metaphor I would pay attention to, just because the association of white with purity and virginity and fertility, even to me, I try to abstain from making those types of comparisons, which are rife throughout the system of white supremacy. I think earlier in the text, he even used a metaphor where he associated whiteness with a fog, where people, you know, couldn't really see things correctly. But yeah, I thought that metaphor was pretty striking at the very beginning of the reading this week, at the top of chapter 12. Let's see, next. It seems like he is doing quite a bit of Tomming. He would certainly seem to qualify as an Uncle Tom in his role, social worker, even previously at the CIA, might be a reason for a VGQ. Everyone, just because a non-white person appears to be quote-unquote Tomming, they might have a counter-racist agenda where this is a part of their plan. That might be further reason to extend VGQ. I thought it was a telling passage at the bottom where it said Freeman thought that there was little to choose from among the black middle class chicks available, and that risking the wrath of an insecure middle class Negro whose only available test of manhood was confined to the boundaries of his bed was a waste of time and energy. I thought that was really striking on two accounts. The latter being, he says, time and energy, reminding me very much of Mr. Fuller, and just making logical assessments. And I think this is where Mr. Fuller would say it's logic. It's following the logic. And I think that starting to just codify that the way we use our time and energy would be just massive in terms of making progress and solving this problem. But also him not wanting to have conflict with another black person with regards to sexual intercourse. So I'm not going to bother anybody. If a female is already in some sort of arrangement, then I'm not going to try to talk to her. That way I avoid conflict with other black people. Wow. When he talks about giving his speeches as a social worker, he says he knew that his speeches were intended for entertainment rather than enlightenment, and he spiced them with the white man's statistics concerning Negro crime. Wow, Mr. Greenlee. That is a piercing critique, and I do think that that happens frequently, that black people are encouraged, groomed, expected to talk about white supremacy in a way that is entertaining, that is not really about the business of solving problems. That's why I think there's such widespread disdain for the cows. I hope is that we do not talk about racism, white supremacy, so that it is entertaining, particularly not entertaining for racist man, racist woman, racist child. Let's see, the next thing. The scene where he describes the 15-year-old black child being shot and killed. Heard that before so many times. You know, Laquan McDonald. You could just go on down the list. Bette Smith. Doesn't have to be Chicago, but just heard that before. I thought it was important at the end of the paragraph where he's describing the shooting, where he says the riot-trained police. That stood out to me. Racist man, racist woman. They train for riots. They admit it. I remember back in Ferguson, 2014, the governor and other white officials came out and said, we are prepared. We have trained. We have had hundreds of hours of training for riot control. They were saying this. That alone, in my opinion, shows the folly, the lack of logic in participating in riots. It's not about morality or whatever. It's just they train for riots. We don't. They are going to be much better prepared to handle whenever this type of thing happens, which they have shown every time. That's what happens here until it goes, this is fiction, until it goes off into the fiction. But that's what happens. I mean, when you see the real world nonfiction version of how these events last, we never win. That's never what happens when these things go down. They train for these. We do not. They expect these things to happen under the system of white supremacy. I thought it was a significant use of the term spades, again, where they reference having spades in plain clothes, telling them, black people in Chicago, to cool it and to go home. I mentioned that last week in terms of when black people get referenced as spades in this book. Dawson's line here where he says, these people would spend 10 minutes in a picket line, but they fight all night. We've been lucky so far, but you know Chicago, if they really goes, it will make these other riots look like picnics. Even that phrasing, like picnics, it reminded me of B. Moore. If she's listening, you can message me on Facebook, but I know she has pointed out consistently, as have many others, just the term picnic and the connotation for lynching and that being a part of white culture to make the killing of black people entertainment, where we can come out and sit in the grass in our Sunday finest and have a meal and watch a black person be castrated and talk about genital mutilation and tortured, and then we'll cart off their testicles and put them in a jar and we'll sit out and have a meal. you know, in the nice soft grass and watch all this go down. But it reminded me of that. And even that's the way these riots tend to go. That tends to be what happened. Particularly, wasn't that what happened at Ferguson? I said it was not a picnic. It was just you could snuggle up for primetime TV on the couch with your popcorn and watch, you know, the Negro hooliganism in Ferguson after, you know, no indictment for Michael Brown being shot and killed. That's very much what it reminded me of. But just the word picnics there. Let's see. Welsing moment for me where it says later on, cops spoke busily into their car radios and handy talkies everywhere. They clutched their nightsticks tightly like magic wands, which would give them strength, beauty, and power. Very much a Welsing moment to me. Some correlation to the phallic symbol. We've talked about the nightsticks before, a.k.a. nigger knockers. Next thing. Lots of instances in this week's session that white people are stupid. It came up repeatedly that white people are stupid and stubborn about Negroes. He would not believe that Negroes would not continue to passively accept the pushing around that whites had come to think of as their birthright. I noted that, number one, because it says white people are stupid, and then saying passively thinking that black people would have just allowed themselves to be pushed around. I would say that that is not a true statement. That is not an accurate assessment of whites. Whites have never at any time sat passively by and just thinking that black people are dumb and stupid and they are just going to be easily pushed around forever. That is so far from being the truth that it is dangerous. I can even cite when Roz asked Dr. Martin Kevorkian when he was on the program this summer, and he asked him who is, our caller in Michigan's question, who is more confused about racism, white people or black people? And he cited the anecdote about Nat Turner. Was it, it might not be Nat Turner. I think it was either Nat Turner or Frederick Douglass. I have Nat Turner on my mind, but it was a black person from the 19th century, enslaved black person, 19th century, where learned how to read, and he said that the white people were not surprised that he knew how to read. Black people were. And that was a part of his response in saying that black people are more confused about racism. White people are not confused at all. White people have no illusion that black people are just going to sit around and take this passively. That is why they do. I've mentioned that all the time. That's why they do all of this stuff. That's why they have a COINTELPRO program. That's why they work to make sure a film like this doesn't come out, or a film like The Birth of a Nation, that you don't go see it. Like, they know that black people, they know about Nat Turner. They've written books about Nat Turner. They know about, they have riot prepare squad. Even he says that within, in the same chapter, they have riot preparedness drills. So they know, they expect these things to happen. I always go back to COINTELPRO, Dr. Kenneth O'Reilly's book, Racial Matters, the FBI secret file on black America from 1960 to 1972, where he has like documentation. You can look at the records of them spying on black people who had $30 in the bank. It's painful, but that is the level of, that is in no way indicative of white people thinking, oh yeah, these, you know, moron Negroes, we got them. It's going to be no problem. That's not how they're thinking at all. They know. I think that was one of the main points of Dr. O'Reilly's book, in saying that black people are treated like garbage. Their loyalties are suspect. He said that has been the modus operandi for centuries, really, under the system of white supremacy. We know we treat them, you know, with no level of humanity. We know it's constant warfare. It's constant terrorism against these people. We got to be very suspicious about their motives and what have you. Even while they're pushing all the tales from the plantation about us being happy about all this, they know that that is some racist nonsense. I belabored that. Moving forward. The welfare raids on women's rooms in the middle of the night in an effort to catch a man there, reminding me of Dr. Welsing again, and something we've talked about before on the program, and just another way that they keep conflict between black males and black females. Let's see. Few last things that I have. The disdain, the racism that the white Chicago police officers showed towards Dawson, them, you know, having no regard for him having some sort of authority. This is supposed to be a black supervisor. They don't care. We'll do what we want to do. We'll bring in the dogs, whatever. It reminded me very much of Tamir Rice, even though that was in Cleveland, where the portion where he says a three-year-old girl, she's bleeding something awful. They got her in an ambulance and won't let her mother near her. The bastards reminded me of when Tamir Rice was shot and killed and his mother was not allowed, thrown in a police vehicle, not allowed to be with him as her child lay dying, even sister being thrown on the ground. The last note, when they're ending chapter 13, when Pete Dawson, when he says, "Why do they always mess it up?" I think it's just getting an accurate understanding. This is not a quote-unquote mess up. This is supposed to happen in the system of white supremacy. This is what it is designed to do. Brutalize, terrorize, pillage black people. This is not a quote-unquote mistake. They love and prepare for this sort of thing, have been doing it for years. The last two things I wanted to get in. Number one, Nate Parker was on The Breakfast Club today. Very interesting interview. He said context like a lot of times. But they were asking about the film, and somehow Django came up. They said it was important to have Django. I think they even compared Nat Turner to Django. And I thought that that was just so sad, because that is how powerful the system of white supremacy is, where a racist like Quentin Tarantino, his like ridiculous racist narrative, like pornographic distortion of the enslavement of black people, becomes like the template. This becomes the first thing that we think of when we think of black people and using counter violence against white supremacy, becomes his, you know, nonsensical, cartoonish version, not like authentic black people who did this, like not just reciting these people that actually lived, not out of the brain computer of some racist, but actual black people that lived and fought and killed white people in order to secure black liberation. Like, I just thought it was a painful moment for me, but that is what we're trying to correct. But it very much reminded me of this film. Both, I think, are examples of counterviolence, Nate Parker's work, and The Spook Who Sat by the Door. And to me, it seems like the exact same machinations they attributed to COINTELPRO, the FBI, the CIA, in the suppression of The Spook Who Sat by the Door, the media campaign to encourage people not to see the film, that Nate Parker, you know, he raped this white girl and he's not apologetic. It seems very similar to me, the effort to discourage people, or somehow, some way, whether you decide not to see the film because of all the attention on him being a rapist, or whether you just don't have access to it. We make sure that it's not in theaters, which has happened even with Nate Parker's work, but to make sure that the film is not in theaters a long time, it disappears, and then it's not available on VHS or anything like that, so that people don't see this film, so that people are not sparked to think that way. It very much reminds me, it seems like a lot of correlations there. This is at least the second book that we've read about Chicago, maybe even the third with Isabel Wilkerson. Leonida McLean, A Foot in Each World. Chicago has been terrible, like, forever. We've read two great books looking at Chicago, and it just seems like any era, regardless of how much they're talking about it right now, that racists have just dedicated a lot of time and energy to making sure that black Chicagoans are in misery. Beryl Satter as well, Family Property. We've done quite a few books on Chicago. That is it. Oh, and I wanted to point out, Thomas in New York did not quite answer the question. He talked more about current enforcement officers not behaving like Phil Dawson. He did not say whether or not Phil Dawson was white or not. He said they were not behaving like Phil Dawson, but I didn't hear a clear answer as to whether or not Phil Dawson is white because he's an enforcement official. Did folks have other comments they wanted to get in?
First, I wanted to say, very well written, this the way that this reading was. I should have pointed this out at the first time I called in and chimed in, but
You know, the writing in this section was excellent, I think, especially at the beginning. Very accurate depiction of the snow, how it melts, you know, during the day becoming like slush. Feels like walking through mud and freezes at night in the odd shapes it was left in. I mean, very detailed description. It's Officer Dawson black in 1973? Yes, he's a black man. Yes, he was. The question, I had two questions for you, however. If this was to happen today, and blacks are codified, fully prepared to fight back, reorganized, would you trust a black cop?
I would point out that even the author, Sam Greenlee, said that this is like farcical to think that this would happen in the way that he's written it in this book today. He did not think that that was a possibility, but that notwithstanding, if it did happen, my counter-racist code is that I don't trust anybody. I would assume, I mean, it would take a long time to develop that. So it would not matter if he was a cop. It wouldn't matter if it was just a regular non-white person. If that was to happen, exactly as Mr. Fuller recommends in his code book, any sort of counterviolent action, that should be you by yourself. That's not something where you're talking. I wouldn't be talking to it with anybody, enforcement officer, black or otherwise, anybody. I wouldn't be on the radio talking about it. I mean, if you're going to do counterviolence, that's not supposed to be something that's, you know, up for discussion anyway. So that would just be united, independent. That way you keep secrets from getting out. Nate Parker said that on the program today. They were talking about how suppressing information, and yeah, just anything that I did not want to be revealed, anything that I didn't want to get back to racists, I would make sure that I didn't tell anybody.
For you, but before I didn't see the movie, so I don't. I didn't see the Breakfast Club either, so I don't know. You know, how the movie went, but Ori sent me a text saying that it was powerful and very good. By his first glance, it was very good. And I sent him a text back asking him, did they depict white people helping black people? And I didn't get a text back. So that would be my chime, you know, or how, if that was good or not. If they have white people helping, I don't even want to, you know, deal with it. Cause that's not, well, I don't see that, you know, being accurate. My second question for you is, do you think that good old Sheriff Clark would do what Mr. Dawson did? I mean, this is a cop today who recently just arrested a black man on an airplane for calling him out, calling him a sellout, and even telling the guy he closed his parks in his neighborhood. I mean, he was saying some real stuff, too, but he was calling him a Uncle Tom and a sellout. And he arrested the man on an airplane to North Carolina, held him there for the Charlotte police to come in and abuse him. And it said the man was drunk. They charged him with being drunk on an airplane, and it was just ridiculous. So do you think good old Sheriff Clark today would do what Officer Dawson did? Or would he grab the dogs?
Hello?
Everybody still here?
Oh, I was muted. I was muted. Sorry. Sorry about that. I will condense what I said. I said it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant if, you know, Sheriff Clark or any other black enforcement official, Kerr Putney down in Charlotte, that was mentioned, if they do what Dawson did or not, Dawson is not the most powerful person in the book. They show that. He has his little stand facing the dog's tail. You get him out of here, I'll shoot him. And then, you know, whatever, nigga, we'll get you. Whatever, Jig, we'll, you know, we'll deal with you later, and we're going to get these niggas right now, which they do anyway, promptly. So, I mean, it really doesn't matter at the end of the day. Like, I think that's the most important thing to kind of keep in the forefront. Like, you know, regardless of whether Dawson does that or not, you know, we still got this problem here to solve, to stay focused on that and to not get distracted into focusing all of our frustrations on the Phil Dawsons of the world.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I was going to say,
Hang on one second. There was another person we haven't heard from. The caller from a block number.
Good evening, everyone. I think I'm not sure where we stopped today. But it would be difficult to get to your objective as long as they keep throwing Dawsons in the way. I mean, I'm like, you know, Dawson is there and Dawson has to be dealt with before you can get where you want to go, because the person who's going to do you in and stop you from getting anywhere is going to be Dawson. So while you say he's not the most powerful person, he certainly isn't the person to blame for all of this. But man, if you can't get past those Dawsons that they keep throwing at you, you're never going to get to your objective. They will take you out of the game each and every time. And so it's not that you can ignore them, is it? I'm asking a real question here. What do you do about those Dawsons they throw at you?
If it's other non-white people being used in some way by the system of racism, white supremacy, I would think at this point it would be, okay, so we already know that that's going to happen, that they are going to have lots and lots and lots of other victims to pick out, to use in a variety of ways that can cause problems for me. So you go about the business of codifying, how do I, as best I can, avoid getting into conflicts with them, and consistently redirecting so that I'm dealing with the people that are causing problems for me, white people, dealing so that we can address the root of the issue as opposed to getting caught up in all of these other instances. I think when you recognize that that's a big part of the system, I think you just work systematically, deliberately in all areas of people activity to make sure that you're minimizing conflict with non-white people, and particularly where you can see directly that white people are manipulating this and getting these other non-white people to come and be in your way, to go and deal directly with that white person. Because as long as they're in charge, they will have an infinite amount of non-white people to do that. They'll be able to do that forever. And it will be exactly as you'll just be bogged down talking to Dawson all day long and never getting anything done. That's what they want us to do. Fuss at Sheriff Clark all day long, and it has not solved the problem.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
In my years of studying, attempting to study the global system of racism, white supremacy. If we devote our focus, and I used to do it, devote our focus on other non-white people, it is a strategy that benefits the global system of racism, white supremacy. I think what the objective is to find out on what makes the global system of racism, white supremacy powerful over non-white people. And to, once we figure that out, is to neutralize it. And over my years of study, I can't find out a better observation than Mr. Fuller's, which is individually codifying oneself in thought, speech, and action, as opposed to concerning oneself with another non-white person on what they are or aren't doing. Because the global system of racist white supremacy can always replace that example. Could always replace that non-white person. But what the objective is there has to be some kind of motivation for, once that person is removed, that is replaced with another person. Well, whatever that motivation is, that's what we need to be focusing on. I hope I've made some sort of sense. That's it.
Can I be heard?
If you can do your commentary in like 30 seconds.
All right. I was just going to say, I had something else to say, but I was just saying this to piggyback off of what the firefighter Flores just spoke about. What he's speaking of is black self-respect. That's exactly what he's discussing. When you build that up, then that aspect of yourself that would kowtow to a white supremacist and become an automaton of white supremacy would dissipate extremely quickly once you get that black self-respect, that black nigga pride. Thank you.
I do the term automaton in referring to a non-white person. It sounds like name calling. I'd prefer if we not use that.
Oh, I apologize.
No need for apology. Just I try to make an effort if it's a non-white person to not use any terms or labels that they don't use themselves. And I've never heard anyone identify themselves as an automaton. So, yeah, right on. If other folks have commentary on kind of what we ended at, we just want to make sure we get to the second audio segment so we'll have ample time for people to share. So if you have any comments you did not get in from the first audio segment, just make a note and then we'll be able to include you once the second section concludes. So we're picking up. We are on chapter 14, beginning of chapter 14, Context of White Supremacy, Sam Greenlee, The Spook Who Sat by the Door, audio segment number 2. Chapter 14. The chief's car screeched into the intersection. Dawson walked slowly to the car and stood talking intently to the chief. He turned and waved Freeman to the command post. Chief, this is Dan Freeman.
Oh, yes, you're with the Foundation, aren't you?
Been doing a fine job, I hear. Taking a lot of pressure off our precincts down here. They've been trying the same program, but without much success over on the west side. Pete tells me you were in there talking to the teenage gangs. How does it look to you? When it starts, they'll be the most dangerous and the most destructive. They haven't been rumbling, and so they have a lot of latent hostility to get rid of. Now they have a chance to hit out and become neighborhood heroes as well. Usually the folks here are afraid of the gangs and hate them, but it might be different after tonight. I don't think the Cobras will be very active, although some of them will probably attach themselves to other gangs.
Hold on, I thought the Cobras were the worst gang in the city. The chief nodded at Dawson.
They were, Chief. Dawson shook his head and said one word. Junk. The chief nodded. I think most of the trouble will come from the Apaches. They want to take over the reputation of the Cobras around here. There are a couple of smaller gangs who will join in, and there are some of the Comanches in there from the near west side, from the low-cost housing project on the other side of the Dan Ryan Expressway. The Apaches will do the most damage, though. They won't be afraid of anything that moves, and getting shot, beaten, or arrested, they consider a badge of honor. They're going to be hard to control, and some of the older men who have been out of work for a long time will probably join in. There are guns in there, too. Your men will have to watch out for snipers from the rooftops when they go in. I have my street workers on around-the-clock alert. When you think we can help, Dawson knows how to reach me, but they're not likely to listen to any of us now. Not since the dogs. The chief winced. Thanks, Mr. Freeman. Can one of my men drop you anywhere?
No, thanks. My car is not far from here.
Good luck. See you later, Dawes.
Yeah, Freebie. Easy.
Freeman drove his car away and parked it in Washington Park, then walked back to watch. It wouldn't be long before they went for the stores on 51st, and they would probably infiltrate the lines through the alleyways when the police moved into the neighborhood. But they had already started on 47th Street.
the word about the dogs had spread quickly throughout the cordoned off quadrangle, and they had burst into 47th Street before the cops there, relaxing because the reports that things were quieting down, knew that the mood had changed. They moved close to the street through the darkened alleys, then burst out of alleys in several places. Some were caught and arrested, others beaten, but more and more poured into the street. They went for the pawn shops first, smashing the windows and grabbing whatever they could from inside until cops approached, and then scrambled further down the street. By now, there were hundreds in the streets, rampaging, smashing, and finally burning, and south of 47th, when the cops were ordered inside the quadrangle, they burst into 51st as well. They went to the blood-sucking stores as steel filings to a magnet, the pawn shops that contained their few prized possessions, pawned for a fix, a bottle, money to hit a number, to impress a girlfriend, for a wedding, medicine, an abortion. They hit the furniture stores that made more money in interest by reselling the same set of jerry-built furniture to people who could not keep up the payments than if they had sold the junk outright. They hit the supermarkets and liquor stores, and then any store that was owned by whites. They would break in the windows and scramble inside, break the lock on the rear door, and begin to haul stuff out through the back. When the cops arrived, they would leave and move on to the next place being looted. Freeman watched them on 51st, strolling down the raging street. Once a cop swung at him with a club, he dodged the first blow and flashed his badge and ID, but thought he might have to defend himself. The white cops were lashing out at anything black in terror and hate. A small boy struggled down the street with a small Japanese portable television set. A man went by with a stack of six hats on his head, several ties draped around his neck, and a case of bonded bourbon in his arms. A large fat woman waddled down the street with two large hams in each arm. Too slow, she was intercepted and clubbed down by a cop. Three boys in their teens fought savagely with two cops. One of the cops went to his knees, and when he reached for his gun, the three disappeared through a broken store window and out into the alley to its rear. The cops grabbed, clubbed, handcuffed, and arrested. The police vans moved out full of men, women, and children, many of them bloody. Firemen tried to uncoil a hose to put out a fire in a furniture store and were driven away by a group of teenagers. Everywhere there were angry shouts. Burn, baby, burn! Get whitey! Black power! A cop was hit in the face with a brick and helped to an ambulance by two others, blood streaming freely onto his dark blue uniform. A boy, running, slipped on broken glass, and four cops were upon him, beating and poking savagely at his groin with their nightsticks. He screamed and thrashed in pain as they dragged him, bloody and still screaming, to a paddy wagon. Smoke licked up toward the heavy, humid sky. The police shouted. Men, women, and children shouted and screamed in anger, hate, and pain. One large boy of about 19 fought a cop, knocked him to the ground with a swinging right hand, then taking his club, beat him while on the ground. Then, dashing away, he was shot only two steps from the sanctuary of the dark alley. He lay on the sidewalk, moving feebly, while the cops carried his victim to an ambulance. A police car was overturned and set afire. Others had their tires slashed. The army of occupation was being attacked everywhere, and since better equipped, having the better of it. But the police took their casualties from bricks, bottles, baseball bats, and fists. Sporadic firing broke out inside, and Freeman saw two cops brought back to the street, wounded from snipers' fire. The violence spread to 55th to the south, 43rd to the north, a section of Halsted Street on the west side. Everywhere, the pattern was the same. Break, loot, burn, and run. Hurt the cops if you could, run if you couldn't. Take anything of value, stash it at home, and then move back into the streets for more. Smash any store owned by Whitey. He takes your bread to the suburbs where you can't live. He cheats you, overcharges you, insults you and your women. He hates and despises you. Hit him where it will hurt most, in his pocketbook. Stores were stripped, then set ablaze. Everywhere people moved, laden with loot. The cops, both white and black, exhausted, frustrated, no longer feared or in control, struck out whenever they cornered someone. Ghetto cops operate in a state of near paranoia, and now they had been pushed over the line. Their protection, their status, their power is based on fear, and now these people no longer feared them, and the status quo had to be resumed. Gunfire increased. Even people who surrendered when challenged were beaten to the ground and dragged to the ever-waiting vans. There were no longer any efforts to protect property, only efforts to restore law and order at any cost. The clubs were transferred to left hands, and everywhere Freeman looked, there were cops on the prowl with drawn guns. People lay sprawled in the streets and sidewalks, and cops fired at every fleeting shadow. Freeman moved down the middle of the street slowly and smiling, his hands a bit from his sides to show the cops he carried no loot and had no weapons. It was no place now for a black man not in uniform. He thought it would be a hell of a time for him to die, walking innocently down this street, shot by a scared, hate-filled cop. It would be poetic justice, considering what he planned, and he smiled at the thought. He caught the acrid smell of tear gas, borne from inside by a brief, weak breeze. Smoke filled the streets. There was broken glass everywhere, overturned cars, empty cartridge cases, discarded loot, an abandoned pair of handcuffs, a pair of nylon stockings lying in a pool of congealing blood. A puppy cowered beneath a car, whimpering. In the broken window of an electrical appliance store stood a color television console, too large to be carted away, sitting there like a fat, rich dowager on a garbage heap. The rest of the store was littered and empty of its wares. The big set was turned on, and Freeman could see the rioting filmed live and in color. It was a bit out of focus, and he walked over and adjusted a dial until it came in sharp and clear. He watched a moment. Cops on the screen fired at an unseen sniper on a rooftop, the deep voice of the narrator sounding as if he were commenting on a high-budget Hollywood film about the Normandy invasion. Freeman thought the cops looked more heroic on the television set than there on the streets. He turned and walked away. He was stopped three times, and once he talked calmly and inched closer to an hysterical cop who waved a pistol in his face. Before Freeman could disarm him, the cop turned to a wall and sobbed into his folded arms, tightly clutching his pistol and club. Freeman waved to another cop and was almost shot until the cop realized Freeman was not threatening a brother officer. They helped the sobbing policeman into an ambulance and Freeman walked on toward the park. He walked down the middle of the street, past the television cables, cops, cars, cartridge boxes, trucks, television vans, ambulances, equipment, and debris. He stopped facing toward the park a short distance away, listening to the alien sounds. No music, he thought. No good here without the music. He thought of what he would be doing from now on and of the years during which he had prepared himself. He had known that one day this moment would come. He wished it had not. He breathed deeply, trying to shut out the foreign smells until he could grasp one which belonged on this street, and he finally could. He breathed deeply and savored the smell of barbecue. He drove to his apartment and phoned Daddy at the pool room.
"We still here like you say, Turk. Been watching things on TV. Don't look good."
"It looks worse out there in those streets. 3 more days of that, and the people ought to be fed up enough with Whitey to back us."
"What if they stop before then?"
"That's the chance we have to take, but I don't think they will. Not after tonight. The cops will make sure of that. They're going crazy down there. Tomorrow, they'll divide by 10 to come up with casualty figures for the press.
You heard from Stud?"
"Yeah, he called about 15 minutes ago. Man, he having a ball. Almost got burned twice and busted half a dozen times, but he's still loose and raising hell. When he calls again, tell him to get out of sight and lay low as soon as things get tightened there. They'll be looking for him when things quiet down. How about the others?" There was a pause. "They shot Tony, one of the young kids. They took him away in an ambulance. Stud say, so maybe he ain't dead. They only arrest 2 others. Stud say them young Cobras is a bitch. Slippery and mean as hell."
"Okay, I'll check the hospitals tomorrow morning about Tony. Look, you cats better not be seen in the street tonight."
"Nah, Turk, we gonna stay here tonight. We got beer and some food, a deck of cards, and the TV. When we get tired, we can sleep on the tables."
"Okay, baby. I'll call again in the morning. If anything important happens, call me. And tell Stud not to stay down there too long. He's no good to us, dead or in jail."
He hung up, and when he had finished soaking in a hot tub, realized that he was ravenously hungry. He ate a mushroom omelet and almost fell asleep before he had finished eating it. He arose early the next morning and turned on the television set to catch the news while the coffee brewed. The mayor, in a brief statement, said that early reports indicated that agitators and communists were responsible for the rioting. The police commissioner called for a return to law and order and hoped that cooler heads might prevail among the more responsible citizens of the riot-torn area. A prominent University of Chicago professor of sociology stated that the riots indicated an increasing pattern of sadomasochistic tendencies as an outgrowth of increased urbanization, and that the rioting was a parallel to the death wish demonstrated by the Jews in Nazi Germany, since the rioters could only face eventual repression. Prominent Negro leaders, none of whom had been in the riot area in years, in spite of the fact that most lived within walking distance, deplored the riots and advocated nonviolence as the only means of attaining progress for Negroes. A former vice president said that rioters should be shown no mercy regardless of color. The governor of Alabama said, "I told you so." The governor of Illinois announced that the National Guard had been alerted. Freeman took the morning newspaper from his doorstep and read them over his first cup of coffee. A cartoonist pictured a bearded figure in sunglasses with exaggerated Negroid features, clad in t-shirt, blue jeans, and sandals, attacking a figure labeled Civil Rights, clad in a Brooks Brothers suit, necktie, and hat, who looked like a white man colored dark. The editorial called for a return to nonviolent protest, then suggested that nonviolent protest was responsible for the rioting by fostering disrespect for law and order, and ended by predicting that white backlash would negate the great progress thus far achieved in civil rights. Freeman's Senator Hennington predicted that the rioting would hurt the civil rights bill presently on the Senate floor. The president said nothing. His press secretary praised the Negroes fighting for the freedom of the Vietnamese. Three prominent authors, two playwrights, and four movie stars resigned from civil rights organizations in protest. A Negro leader requested the installation of sprinklers on fire hydrants, a swimming pool in the West Side ghetto, and the hiring of Negro pilots by Trans World Airlines. Each of the Negro aldermen denounced hoodlumism, lawlessness, and violence, and praised the mayor for his achievements for the Negro population of Chicago. Their statements were identical because they had been written in the mayor's Office of Public Relations. The House of Representatives Un-American Activities Committee announced they would hold hearings in Chicago to investigate communist agitation among the rioters. The Chicago Tribune requested the National Guard. The Daily News suggested that Negroes prove themselves worthy of full citizenship by becoming model citizens first. The Sun-Times requested an increase in federal anti-poverty funds. Time Life flew in a staff of 63, Newsweek a staff of 38, and the Times of London authorized a round-trip ticket by Greyhound bus for its New York stringer to cover the riots. The television networks thought that riots in the North might replace the now absent police dogs, fire hoses, cattle prods, and mounted state troopers of the South in entertainment value. They each dispatched top flight task forces to cover the rioting in full cover. Antonioni announced plans in Rome to do a Technicolor movie concerning the riots. It would involve one man's agony in trying to decide whether to throw a brick at the police, and the entire movie would take place in a kitchenette apartment. Marcello Mastroianni would play the lead in blackface. Mr. Stevens, chair of the board of the foundation, phoned Freeman and asked that he be present at an emergency meeting of the board at 3:30 that afternoon. Freeman ate a large breakfast and drove to the riot area. Chapter 15. Freeman parked his car outside the cordoned-off riot area and walked through the checkout point after showing his ID to the cop stationed there. A short distance down the street, he found Dawson seated in his patrol car, sipping a cup of coffee, his face drawn with fatigue. Freeman walked over to the car when he waved to him. "Hey, Freebie, what you doing in here? Don't look like much work for you for a while." "Hi, Dawes. Come over to check out the scene. Got a board meeting this afternoon, and they'll want a report." "Okay, hop in. I'm just going to cruise the area." Freeman seated himself next to Dawson. "Where's Turner?" he asked. "At a briefing downtown. They couldn't spare both of us. He'll bring me up to date this afternoon when he gets back." He eased the car into the streets, empty except for official vehicles cruising the neighborhood. The word had spread that the cops had become trigger-happy and the people were in their buildings or sitting silently in groups on the porches, few ventured casually into the streets. "How long since you had some sleep, Dawes?" "Oh, I've been catnapping now and then. They talking about bringing in the National Guard. I don't like the idea of seeing military uniforms in here. And the unit they alerted is an all-white outfit, too. That won't help things at all, but they don't trust the colored guard unit. Or many of us spade cops, either. They've been acting like we started it instead of putting it down. Man, the colored cops worked harder than anyone here." Dawson fell silent a moment, gazing through the windshield. The groups of people on the porches followed the car sullenly with their eyes. The odor of smoke hung heavy in the air, and the police calls from the squad car radio sounded loud because of the unusually quiet streets. "You know, Dan, I grew up around here, but I wonder if I really know or understand these people." "Well," said Freeman, "that badge does put distance between you and the rest." "Yeah," replied Dawson. "I saw some good friends out in that street last night. Not just hoodlums like they say on TV, but some very straight cats. Cats with jobs, families, responsibility. In a scene like that, everybody can get involved, Dawes. It was like it was war, and I was part of the enemy. Some I can understand. They were always in trouble. But what were the others thinking? It wasn't like they hated me. It was like I was in the way of something important they had to do. What good will it do? It's not enough to say they had it tough. They didn't have it any tougher than we did. Without respect for law and order, we might as well be back in the jungle." Dawson parked the car on 51st Street, and they stared at a burned-out store, the burn smell heavy in the rapidly warming late morning air. "Shit, Dawes. The ghetto's always been a jungle. You really think you can treat people like animals and not have them act like animals? You really believe you're just a cop and I'm just a social worker? Man, we're keepers of the zoo. You can't cage a whole race of people without asking for trouble." "You agree with what they did?" Dawson turned to face Freeman, one arm draped on the steering wheel. "No, because it won't mean a thing. You watch how the white folks will turn it around. They'll have a flood of people down here running surveys and shit, all designed to find out how to maintain the racial status quo without paying riot dues. How to get the niggers to go back to sleep. Whitey won't get the message because he doesn't want to get it. Things will quiet down and we'll both go back to working for Mr. Charlie, keeping niggers in their place." The police calls came through the radio with a metallic quality echoing in the quiet street. The sound of an approaching L grew in the distance. "I came by that, Freebie," said Dawson seriously. "Somebody has to do what we're doing, and we're a lot better than most. Don't you think it's better to have a cop who grew up here, who knows the people?" The L stopped at the station just down the street. The people aboard pushed close to the windows to gaze raptly at the ravaged street below. "Better for Whitey. It takes a nigger to catch a nigger." "The streets have to be safe." "Whose streets?" "Were our streets safe for our women when we were kids?" Whitey discovered Negro crime when it spilled out of the ghetto and began threatening him. "They don't give a damn what we do to one another." Two big cops in full riot gear carrying 3-foot riot sticks noticed Freeman in the squad car and approached it in case Dawson needed assistance. Dawson waved them away and started the car, moving west towards State Street. We have to clean up our own backyard before we can expect whites to help us. You come on like Time Magazine, man. The conditions they force us into cause the crime. Then they use the crime to justify the conditions. If every Negro worked as hard as you have to get where you are, we wouldn't have a problem. Later for that, Jazz Dawes. Run twice as fast to get half as far. Whitey sitting there with his hand on the controls of the treadmill, laughing his ass off. I don't think you really believe that. They had turned into an alley, and the backyards were crisscrossed with lines of wash, the back porches crowded with people. One man arose, walked to the railing of his porch, and contemptuously spat at the squad car as it slowly moved down the alley. It's not easy working and going to law school, but in a couple of years, I'll have my degree, and I think it's worth the extra effort. He waved toward the crowded porches. If everyone out there devoted as much energy trying to improve themselves as they did last night, burning and looting, they might be where we are. Where are we? Where the hell are we? How are we any different from them? You know we're not like them. You think we're different because you got a badge and I got a couple degrees? We gotta be. You know what whites call people like you and me in private? What? Niggas. Cool it. He looked at Freeman with an inquiring smile. Freeman, working to control his anger, forced himself to return the smile. I know you don't really believe that stuff, Dan. You're tired and upset about the scene, just like me. Yeah, I guess you're right, Dawes. It does bug me to see all that work go down the drain. When things quiet down again, I have to start right from scratch. How long you been on the force now? Almost 15 years. I can retire with a full pension after 20. I joined right after I dropped out of school when I got hurt, and it finished me for football. How come you quit school? Even though you couldn't play anymore, they figured to continue your ride. Public relations for future recruiting. Yeah, I know. But I just couldn't stay around after having been the big hero. I had two good seasons, Dan. Two very good ones. They were letting freshmen compete in the Big Ten at that time, remember? I made first string as a freshman, and even missing two games the next season after I injured my knee, I made all-conference as a sophomore. He paused, remembering. You would have been a cinch for All-American if you hadn't missed those two games. Even so, you got honorable mention for AP and third string for Look Magazine. That's the hang-up, Dan. Everything was so groovy, and then nothing. Man, I couldn't stay around. The crippled ex-football star. I stayed long enough to take final exams so I'd have the credits for the semester, and then I just came back to Chicago without even saying goodbye to anyone. The school was straight, though. They paid for the operation on the knee, and as soon as it was strong enough to pass the police physical exam, I joined the force, and I've been with them ever since. Freeman asked the next question carefully. Aren't you about due for a promotion? Dawson laughed bitterly. You trying to put me on, Freebie? You know the quota is full up. One spade captain of uniform police and one lieutenant of detectives. If either one drops dead, I'm in. Otherwise, I'm stuck as a sergeant until one retires. They keep telling me how swinging it is to be a detective sergeant at my age, like they doing me a favor, and I had the highest score on the exam when I made sergeant. But it's not so bad. I could be doing a lot worse. Freeman thought Dawson was not quite ready yet, but his justified indignation at not having the rank he deserved might be just the wedge he needed to recruit him. And Freeman thought the things he would see when the guard came into the neighborhood would not enamor Dawson of white folks. He would bide his time, work on him quietly, plant the seeds, and cultivate them over a period of time. Dawson would be a good man. He could take over if they ever blew my cover, Freeman thought. I'll just have to be patient a little bit longer. One day, the white man will force him to make a choice. He can't straddle the fence forever. He looked pretty damn good against those dogs last night. Dawes, why don't we go down to Mama Soul Foods on 47th and eat? I'm starving. Good idea, Freebie. Some pork chops would knock me out. They drove through the checkpoint and on to 47th. They stopped first for a drink in a dark, air-conditioned bar and watched the clubs playing San Francisco on the television set there. They watched long enough to see Willie Mays double in two runs and then walked the short distance to the small restaurant, ordered and ate in silence, each comfortable in the old friendship and lost in their own private thoughts. When they had finished, Dawson drove Freeman to his car and parked just outside the riot area.
Alrighty, that is the end of the second audio segment. We're still in chapter 15. Didn't get to end on a chapter this week, but we have two sessions left, and we will be all done moving on to a new book. But that'll wrap us for the reading this week. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. All the folks who dialed in who have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to chime in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I, as they were describing the quote-unquote riots, just gave a I was just background as far as being a part of riots from the standpoint of on a professional level. Non-white black people don't have a chance. They just don't, some of us just don't know it. That every occasion that we're seeing on television, whether it's Ferguson or Baltimore or whatever, if law enforcement decided that they wanted to kill every last black person in those instances, they could. Right there, live and on living, quote unquote, living color, if they wanted to. My background experience was not the 1980 rebellions that took place down here in Miami. I was still in college at the time. But all the ones that existed down here afterwards. And I had the opportunity to see their planning and their strategy. First of all, we're all born in the system of racism, white supremacy. So, I mean, it's already been established, for one thing. You're in prison, as Mr. Fuller adequately states. And they just take the strategy of stepping back, for the most part. They don't mind risking
some of the uniform personnel. They don't mind a brick getting upside somebody's head or something like that. They're willing. They are quote unquote expendable. They don't care anything about the businesses because those businesses are not vital to the system of racism and white supremacy anyway. Any business that lies within areas where non-white people reside, especially non-white black people, where they reside, is not important to them anyway. Whether it's a non-white person that is not black or black or even a white person that and down here in South Florida, like most places, is concentrated areas where non-white people at it anyway. And they would allow a level of quote unquote rioting, quote unquote looting or whatever, that sort of thing. You just let it happen. I mean, we've actually seen that on television and the quote unquote complaints about it. That's a strategy that they actually are exercising right there in front of our eyes. And if it gets to a level politically to whereas people would look at things in a negative way to law enforcement, then they would enact the National Guard, that sort of thing, to show that we are practicing something called law and order. And a lot of times that's when a lot of non-white black people also would get killed too. But they're just emphasizing on how much prepared they really are. And the I would say silliness even of out there at that time, it's just utterly ridiculous to join in on anything called a riot for a non-white black person to be doing. They're seriously not really aware of what actually is going on. And that's all I have to say as far as from that standpoint. I'll mute my line right now and listen. Thank you.
Appreciate that. The caller at 7722, did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Yes. This is Lamine from Kansas City. I was very captured me this week, the theme of the reading specifically regarding the questions that Freeman used when speaking with Dawson. I found in my experience that a lot of non-white people, when discussing the system of racism and white supremacy with other non-white people, tend to go into an argument mode. But we could see how, in this week's reading, Freeman's codified because they were making, to me, they were very codified because they were making Dawson think and they were drawing him out. And he realized, you know, look, for what Freeman was trying to do, recruit him, he just had to, hey, it's not time, just kind of walk away. It's so much more constructive when we use questions. Like Mr. Fuller says, you know, just follow the logic as opposed to trying to preach or put our doctrine or our thoughts, because we haven't solved the system yet. You know, we haven't fixed it. So just seeing Freeman use those questions to kind of make Dawson think really kind of, I think, was a good example, you know, especially for non-white people. And another thing, kind of like the last call, retired firefighter, I was thinking, you know, rioting. Everybody likes to just go out and ride, and it seems to be the activity du jour. However, we got history of this type of behavior, just kind of doing what works. And non-white people, we really don't think critically about, hey, these people are preparing, they're practicing. And then I like that scene where he's watching the television, and he's watching the riot go on while he's in the riot. And that's just, white people enjoy that. They literally, it's a spectacle. It's like a Roman, it's a spectacle to them. They enjoy to watch specifically non-white people in these situations. And man, it's just, you know, with some of the parallels today, but again, this has been the history of white people and the way that they treat non-whites when they have these quote-unquote these riots, these rebellions. And then I thought about the scene where they were going after the stores of the different people who he called bloodsuckers for the community, the pawn shops and whatnot, just showing a lot of confusion on the part of non-white people with hams and hats and just so much confusion that we face, and just the need for us to stay busy and trying to stay constructive. And we could see the result of what other riots that happened today and where they went. But I kind of, those scenes really stood out to me as ways for us to learn how to be more constructive with our.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I wanted to say previously before we started this second session, one thing I thought about is when we look at the suppression of movies like this, the suppression of movies like The Birth of a Nation, it should really be a sign to Black people that there's something white people are trying to keep us from or keep from us. And it's really, when you look at The Spook Who Sat by the Door, or I haven't seen The Birth of a Nation, but I know the premise of the movie. Essentially, anything that shows Black self-respect, any sort of entertainment or media that shows Black people in a light that's other than subservient or abused or terrorized, is something that they don't want us to have access to. And if we just looked at that one simple thing critically, it'll let us know that what Dr. Lawson always talked about in regards to Black self-respect is like really the strongest thing that they had to fight to suppress in us in order for this system to be as successful as it has been for so long. To get to the reading, I had a strong Dr. Welsing moment, and it just came out of like one sentence, I think, or two. This is on page 172. It says, the television networks thought that riots in the North might replace the now absent police dogs, fire hoses, cattle prods, and mounted state troopers of the South in entertainment value. And just that line just stood out to me because it just made me take a holistic look at the law enforcement community and those other paramilitary groups that would include the fire department too. And I just thought about it. I was like, wow, the white people are so obsessed with genetic annihilation that just about all the implements police use are phallic symbols, whether it's the nightstick, the nigger knocker, the gun, the cattle prod, and then the cattle prod was really the prototype for what we now see as a taser. And a taser are actually, they stick them in a bull's rectum in order to stimulate their prostate to force them to ejaculate when they're trying to breed them with females. So just the use of a cattle prod and the fact that it's actually the scientific use for it is to stick it in the rectum of a male cow to get them to ejaculate on call for the procreation of another, another baby cow for the most part. It just made me really think about that. Then you look at the fire department when they would use the hoses on our people, and the water tank would be the testicles. Of course, the phallic symbol would be the hose. I mean, it's just like everything that they do and anything that they create, missiles, bullets, it's all about, phallic symbol and the destruction of life versus the actual phallic symbol in the creation of life. And that just stood out to me with that one sentence. The other thing I wanted to touch on, there was this section that Mr. Greenlee wrote on page 174. Yeah, replied Dawson. I saw some good friends out there in the street last night, not just hoodlums like they say on TV, but some very straight cats with jobs, families, responsibility. In a scene like that, everybody could get involved, Dawes. And again, that just speaks to the fact that when these things happen, even people that you would not suspect, people who probably might ignore the entire beginning part of the struggle, when everything starts to really, really take off, the most unsuspecting people are the people, are also people that would be fed up and might be willing to facilitate helping replace the system of white supremacy with the system of justice. So it made me think about that. And then right beneath that, there's another paragraph he wrote.
It was like it was war, and I was a part of the enemy. Some I can understand they were always in trouble, but what were the others thinking? It wasn't like they hated me. It was like I was in the way of something important they had to do. What good will it do? It's not enough to say they had it tough. They didn't have it any tougher than we did. Without respect for law and order, we might as well be back in the jungle. And what I thought about with that is essentially the fact that Dawes was conscious black man, and it seems to me like there's a dialectical situation in his mind in regards to him being a cop versus being a black male, and the fact that he felt he was in the way of something important. And I think that he already knew what that was, which was these people were really fed up. But even though we were not necessarily in a situation where we could have done anything comprehensive at that point, the idea is that he sees something brewing. And I think that's something that speaks to that dialectical subconscious argument he might be having with himself between being a cop and his allegiance to that versus his allegiance to being a black person and an oppressed black person at that. Also, when he discusses the whole concept of a law and order, and the jungle, of course, would allude to that when you talk about the metaphors as Africa being, you know, a place with savages, you know, spear chuckers and grass skirts, you know, and cannibals. And then I thought about, well, whose version of law and order is he speaking about? Because law and order for black people before we encounter white people is not the law and order that has been placed upon us for the last 500 years in this country. So again, even his concept of law and order, he received from the enemy due to his training. So that was something that made me, that stood out to me as well. And lastly, on page 177, Mr. Greenlee writes, if everyone out there devoted as much energy trying to improve themselves as they did last night, burning and looting, they might be where we are. Where we are? Where the hell are we? How are we any different from them? You know we're not like them. You think we're different because you got a badge and I got a couple of degrees? We gotta be. You know what whites call people like you and me in private? What? Niggers. And this just kind of speaks to how when we are indoctrinated into the system of white supremacy via education, that a lot of times it's not just that you're getting information from your enemy, but what they're doing is they're refashioning you into a black version of themselves. That's what the whole educational process is to get you to be a pseudo version of them and understand your place in their system so that you fit in where they want you to fit in once they educate, edit, and dictate what you are to be. Idea is to, once they do so, they force you to psychologically separate yourself from other people who have not had a similar upbringing to yourself or a similar experience, and then make you look at just the other people who look at you as less than yourself, which of course facilitates anti-blackness in a subconscious manner that I think can manifest itself in how police and other educated black people deal with each other.
Leave it there.
I'll meet my line.
Appreciate it. The caller at 5771, 5771, did you have commentary?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Not much to say, but there was something that stuck out with me with this current reading. Obviously, you know, like in the earlier session, they had the situation with the dogs and how the police used the dogs against the people. But I kind of caught, you know, something that caught my eye that, you know, it was just a running theme throughout the book about how they refer to each other as cats. And I thought about, like, the dog-cat kind of metaphor symbolism between that. You know, it's like we all know the history of dogs that, you know, used against our people and, you know, how the white man likes to, you know, use these dogs to attack because, you know, obviously in most cultures, dogs are symbols of loyalty. But, you know, I started thinking about the cat and why were we calling each other cats, you know, back then, you know, during that time. You know, cats in some cultures are, you know, symbolism of mystery, but also as independence. And, you know, I thought about the symbol of the Black Panther and how the Black Panther Party used symbol of a cat, you know, as their, you know, as their as their symbol. So, but I thought it was just interesting how that little metaphor and symbol, you know, phrases that. And also too, it's like, you know, how do we come to a point where we started, you know, reference each other as dogs? You know, that's my dog right there. You know, and how do we go from calling each other cats? So, you know, just a couple of rants that I had. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that. Thank you for the observations. Did retired firefighter or the caller in New York, did y'all have commentary that you wanted to get in? Or, excuse me, not retired firefighter, Karma. Karma or Thomas in New York, did you two have commentary you wanted to get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, good evening, again. Yes, sir. I did another book that touched on some of the racism and police brutality and stuff in Chicago. It was Richard Williams' book, Race the Way I See, I think it was called, but Savina and Venus's father, that he moved to Chicago, getting into fighting with the cops. I don't know if you remember that, but that was, you know, pretty much showing that. You know, this is a great book and great movie. However, I agree with the firefighter. This is very unrealistic because what's left out in the text that, you know, that would have played a big role in this is the Chicago regular white people. I don't see them standing for too much lawlessness out there. We saw the Cicero, how they treated Dr. King around the same time. And the white people in Chicago seemed like they were pretty much not going to stand for too much nigger uprisings. You mentioned earlier, Gus, Chicago has always been bad. And today Chicago is built as the worst city in the country. And, you know, 492 murders last year. But the year this movie came out, Chicago had 862 murders. That was 370 more murders, which is astounding, you know, because I've been saying it's a reason why they keep saying Chicago so bad today. It's not because of all the murders. On the murders for their history. I mean, 370 more murders in 1973. That's a huge amount of murders. And what really caught my eye when I was looking at the numbers, in 1964 is when they started. So the book was made in 1963. So they don't have those numbers. The 1964, they had 390 murders. So, I mean, what would make them go in 10 years from 390 murders to 862? That's a lot. And I just wanted to say I wasn't using Sheriff Clark as a racist, you know, as trying to make fun of him. I was just using him as a metaphor. I personally like Sheriff Clark. I love when he comes on TV. I get my popcorn and listen to his commentary. I find it quite amusing. And I'm with my line. Thank you.
Right on, right on. A couple quick comments I will get in. We should still have time if folks have additional comments they want to share. I'm so glad that the book slightly differs from the movie, because those, I think, are two of the iconic moments from the film. The exchange between Dan Freeman and Pete Dawson after the quote-unquote riots, when he says, you know what they call us when behind our backs, and he says niggers, and he repeats it a few times, and then Dawson whistles, and it's like, oh, I haven't heard you talk like that since that, like, iconic scene. And then the scene from the first audio segment this week where Dan Freeman and Pretty Willie are having the discussion about the bank robbery, and he says, I was born black, I died black, and that's on the Dead Prez, their debut album. I was going to play that to start with, since it's not written exactly like it. I was glad, since I wouldn't have to read, you know, all of that intense dialogue. But we did cover two of the more prominent moments in the movie in this week's section. Incidentally, there was a New York Times review of the movie by Vincent Canby. This is from September of 1973, where he says, like Dan Greenlee's novel on which it's based, The Spook Who Sat by the Door is a difficult work to judge coherently. It is such a mixture of passion, humor, hindsight, prophecy, prejudice, and reaction that the fact that it's not a very well-made movie and is seldom convincing as melodrama is almost beside the point. The rage it projects is real, even though the means by which that rage is projected are stereotypes, black as well as white. Mr. Greenlee, who adapted his novel for the screen with Melvin Clay and co-produced the film with Ivan Dixon, the director, couldn't care less about convincing white audiences of anything except black anger. The white characters are even more idiotic than can easily be explained by their roles as CIA officials and the United States senators. The blacks are either poetic proles or members of the corrupted black middle class. He goes on to get in his other commentaries about the film. It's pretty interesting. It even reminded me of some of the reviews I've seen of The Birth of a Nation over the past week. And I'm even reminded, John Patash mentions this regularly, that part of COINTELPRO, a big part, is having people either work as operatives for papers like the New York Times and other mainstream publications and write documents that are actually CIA, FBI papers, but they will just be under a pen name, ghostwritten, as they say, by someone who is allegedly a journalist. Moving forward, section that I did not get to read from the first audio segment, where it said, the unemployed who stubbornly hoped were in the loop and at the factories on the periphery of the city looking for jobs that did not exist, their more realistic black brothers stood and joked in front of the pool rooms, sat in front of countless TV sets and countless bars, or drank beer from quart bottles and paper bags. I thought that was significant, just him saying that the black people that are more realistic about this, they have kind of checked out. They're just, you know, vegetating, escaping through television, narcotics, drugs, sedating, self-medicating, to try to distance from the daily terrorism of white supremacy. I thought that was pretty interesting, even to me suggesting that there is some level of self-delusion about racism, white supremacy, and how much of a problem that is going to be in our lives. Some of the other things that stood out, I think there's even a concession, Mr. Greenlee, when he says about the riot and the awesome differential of force, where he says the army of occupation was being attacked everywhere and since better equipped, having the better of it. But the police took their casualties from bricks, bottles, baseball bats, and fists. They have what they call riot gear, meaning they have technology that is specifically designed for these type of situations. We don't. Again, just emphasizing the logic, making business-like decisions about whether or not rioting is something constructive we want to participate in. This point reminded me, I think, our black female caller in New York, where she was talking about the Hurricane Matthew damage in Haiti and how the initial numbers were like 5 and then it went to 100 and now it's closer to 300, that she said you should probably multiply that number by 2 or 3. They always minimize black life, black deaths. And they said exactly in the passage here that the cops will make sure of that. They're going crazy down there. Tomorrow they'll divide by 10 to come up with the casualty figures for the press. Again, devaluing black life, which is consistent whether you're talking about what's happening in Haiti right now, what's happened in Haiti previously, Black Wall Street, just pick an incident. The portion where it says, so the response to the riot, Negro leaders requested the installation of sprinklers on fire hydrants, a swimming pool in the West Side ghetto, and the hiring of Negro pilots by Trans World Airlines. Each of the Negro aldermen denounced hoodlumism, lawlessness, and violence, and praised the mayor for his achievements for the Negro population of Chicago. Their statements were identical because they had been written in the mayor's office of public relations. Again, the ghostwriting. And again, just in my opinion, the folly. They can create these quote-unquote Negro leaders faster than we can bash them. That was the question that Karma asked that they crank out these victims of racism to support the system in a variety of different ways. What to do, I think, recognizing it. I don't think that you ignore. I think you recognize and figure out ways of making sure that you consistently are addressing, getting at the root of what's producing this problem, and even figuring out ways of, okay, they're going to have these non-white people designing to cause me problems. I'm going to figure out as many ways as possible where I am subverting them, I'm getting around them and not getting bogged down into some long view that goes nowhere with them, and just staying focused on solving my problem. Greater objective, white supremacy, and then small problems incrementally in solving that greater objective. I think that's what should be done, but I just don't think focusing a lot of energy, name calling, and brawling with these folks is going to take. There's no evidence it's been successful thus far. Seems like the Chicago citizens, Dawson, he says, they don't trust the colored guard unit or many of us spade cops either. There's that word spade again. They've been acting like we started it instead of putting it down. Man, the colored cops worked harder than anyone here. I did want to say the earlier point that there are no Phil Dawsons now. That is not true. Graham Weatherspoon, you can just search his name, Graham Weatherspoon, black enforcement official in New York. I would submit him as someone, if we're saying that being like Phil Dawson, being a black enforcement official who is still acting in a counter-racist way, trying to not do harm to black people and even trying to help black people as best they can, and fighting against racism even amongst other officers, I would submit Graham Weatherspoon. I would also submit, you have to forgive me, check John Patash, second time mentioning his name, his book. He has the name of the black female officer in the Abner Bulima case. This is the black male who was sodomized by enforcement officials. She helped testify against him. She ended up losing her job in the process, but there are quite a few names. I made a Facebook post where I just went down and listed, but there are a lot of black enforcement officials who have stepped forward and called out their peers. There's a black enforcement officer in New York right now who has a lawsuit pending against his own department for practicing racism. He recorded them. He got them saying that they were going out to target black people, that those folks do exist. That just does not get, you know, the same type of publicity. They have technology for riots. They have 3-foot riot sticks. Again, they are prepared for this. We are not. This notion that we have to clean up our own backyards before we can expect whites to help us, I think they call it respectability politics now. Again, I think that's rooted in the same misconception, thinking that somehow we can get whites to stop practicing racism, and that's just not going to happen. And I think until we're honest about that and not fooling ourselves about that, and that understanding is reflected in our behavior, we're going to continue to have this problem. Last thing, reminded me of the Oreo Experience, legendary guest on the Cows. Her term that she coined, regular black people, she normally just gives the acronym RBG, regular black, or excuse me, RBPs, regular black people, RBP. But yeah, this somehow thinking that you are different. I think that even came up with O.J. Simpson as well, somehow thinking that you are special, that you have been accepted, and frequently we get that rude awakening when we find out that no, you are still a nigger. Sorry about that. I think I will stop there. We did our 3 hours, and we are almost done with the movie. I really try and avoid getting folks who called in late. The caller that dialed in last minute, did you have something that you can get in, like in the last 30 seconds?
No, I won't keep anyone. But what's the next book?
Well, I wanted to do Lothrop Stoddard, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy. Dr. Welsing, she requested that we do, or not requested, she recommended, she encouraged that black people read this book. She was saying this at the last Welsing Institute, and she was relating it to the election and just the whole climate of what she was seeing. I thought we should do that for the book club. However, I've kind of hijacked some of these selections. The last book that listeners picked was Medical Apartheid. I picked Blood Brothers and this book. So Lothrop Stoddard's, that would be my selection too. I was also thinking we could do The Delectable Negro to coincide with Birth of a Nation coming out. There was another book. It's the book that they just based the NASA movie on. My primary choice would be Lothrop Stoddard, unless like there's a revolt, and people are like, we just don't want to read that or whatever the case. But I think we should honor Dr. Welsing's request and take care of that one. So that'll be it, unless there's, you know, convincing commentary as to why we should do something else right now.
Well, of course. Can you spell that, please?
I can. It's LOTHROP Stoddard. His last name is STODDARD. Lothrop Stoddard, and it's The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy. It is free. It's old enough. This book came out like at the very beginning of the 20th century, so some of the copyrights have fallen away. So you can, it's freely available. You can download the PDF or the EPUB or whatever version you need, and you can have a hard copy ready to roll.
Thank you.
Grant, we will be here tomorrow. Compensatory call in 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. If you have commentary on the book, we have 2 weeks left, so you should email. If you're listening to the archives, you have something that you want to contribute, I will share it on the air. Thanks to all of the folks for contributing. I hope you got something constructive from what was shared, and I'm enjoying going through the book. Two more left and we'll be done. I will state again, alcohol was kind of normalized. I'd said that before about cigarettes being very normalized within this text. We have different people smoking cigarettes. That's in the movie, too. Alcohol is pretty normalized here as well. I know that that is authentic, unfortunately. You do have a lot of black people then and now who consume all of these narcotics in self-medicating against racism, white supremacy. But I've just seen evidence that it frequently creates new problems instead of helping us to solve our current problems. In that vein, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism, particularly if you're going to be in a motor vehicle. We already know racists are on the hunt for us. We should have that in mind. That's whether you're going to be a driver, passenger, even as a pedestrian. You never know when today will be the day that you bump into Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any of these other race soldiers, badge or no. Our behavior should reflect at all times that war is being waged against us. We want to make sure we're in the best state of mind to perform counter-racism at any moment. That's it. We'll be here tomorrow. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. The email, untiljustice@gmail.com. If you have questions, problems, confusions, gripes, guest suggestions, feel free. untiljustice@gmail.com. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact, with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice. Immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.